Ladies and gentlemen, recorded in Fredericton, New Brunswick, Canada, it's time for Bite Night Picks with your hosts, Frank
and Matt
Allen. And just like that, we're back, getting set for UFC Fight Night, Pavlovich versus Blades, coming at you back-to-back cards at the UFC's Apex. They spent $100 million on the facility, and they have to pay for it somehow, and it's with fights like these. As always, one half of your hosting duo, Craig Allen, Twitter and Instagram, at Craig Allen FNP. With me to my left, to your right, respective socials, Matt Allen FNP, looking to pick up the pieces from
what a UFC terrible week we just had.
Fight Night, Holloway versus Allen. But Matt, when we do focus forward on this card, 13 total fights headlined by those two big heavyweight finishers in the main event. Sergey Pavlovich, 5 straight first round knockout wins after losing his UFC debut against the venerable Alistair Overeem. For Curtis Blaydes, I mean, 3 big wins in his own right. His last time out, obviously disappointing the way that it finished, the Tom Aspinall knee injury, but he's looking to get a convincing win. These two guys in the top 5 of the division, and in the co-main event, top ranked guys
exactly
in the most competitive division in all of MMA, the bantamweight division. Song Yadong taking on Ricky Simon, and both these guys, I mean, Simon 8-2 in the UFC, Song Yadong 8-2 with a draw. I mean, this card is filled top to bottom with a lot of question marks, but up at the top, a lot of big-time fights.
I don't know about you, but when I initially looked at this card, I guess last week before the Max Holloway-Arnold Allen card, I was a little bit down on it. I felt like I was going to have sort of that big card hangover, but as I broke this fight card down, there's a lot of really fun fights on this card. We talk about Bobby Green, Jared Gordon. Like, that's a fun fight where that could be like a prelim main event on a pay-per-view even. That's how fun of a fight that is. Tavares Silva, like, these might not be the biggest names in the world, but these are competitive fights that should result in sort of fight the night style matchups.
Well, when you do look at it, as we always do with Fight Night Picks, we're going to throw it on over to our fight of the night screen. Make sure you let us know down below in the comments who you have in the fight of the night.
Let us know down below in the comment section who you've got. It's time for the fight of the night with Fight Night Picks.
So when we're talking fight of the night, Brad Tavares has been in the UFC since the Ultimate Fighter 11. He's never won a bonus. But his last time out, I mean, you talk about a fight of the night runner-up at UFC, what was it, 274? If you look at it for 276. So Brad Tavares has been in the UFC since the Ultimate Fighter season 11. He's never won a bonus. Like, he's been around a time or two. Second most decision wins in company history behind Neil Magny. Tavares has 12 of them. But it's last time out, I mean, a fight of the night runner-up. Barbarina versus Lawler, get it done, UFC 276. But Tavares against everybody's favorite whipping boy in the middleweight division, Dricus du Plessis, that was a banger. For Bruno Silva, came in 3 straight finish wins off a USADA suspension, and then he loses to Pereira, and his last time out, I mean, he looked like a hot mess against Joe Mearshart. So in this one, it's a get-right fight for both of these guys. There's a lot on the line, and Tavares versus Silva, they wouldn't have put them in a slot before the co-main event if they didn't expect fireworks.
I think it's going to be an incredible fight because Brad Tavares, I don't mean this disrespectfully, but he is a very high-level gatekeeper for the middleweight division. If you beat Brad Tavares, you're only going to go on and fight really high levels of opposition after. Look at Edmund Shabazian. He was able to beat Brad Tavares and then kind of hit the skids afterwards, because after you beat Tavares, you're a big name. You're going to start fighting ranked opponents. So for Silva, I think this is a really good opponent for him to go in there against, because Tavares is a steady fighter. He's not going to offer you any real big surprises. He's not going to throw kicks like Yair Rodriguez. He has steady boxing, good wrestling. You know what you're going to get. So for a guy like Bruno Silva with his kind of extreme way of fighting, I think this is a great matchup at middleweight.
And when you're making a second pick, I know Bobby Green's got a lot of fight of the nights in the UFC. Jared Gordon also has a fight of the night bonus. But when you look at this matchup, Matt, Ricky Glenn taking on Christos Yagos. Yagos has won bonuses. Glenn's won a bonus. Like, if you look at these two guys in the lightweight division, I know for Glenn, former World Series champ at featherweight, and it's been up and down in the UFC. Christos Yagos has been so up and down in the UFC that he's had 2 stints of the promotion. So for both of these guys, again, another get-right fight. They're both coming off of fairly significant layoffs. Big injury for Yagos, and Glenn, question marks because he does, you know, kind of radio silence between his fights.
Yeah.
So a big-time matchup in this division, and a little bit of a clash of styles, too.
And it's a really fun fight because both guys love the volume game. So I can see this fight being one where we see kind of triple-digit volume numbers for both guys. If we're Glenn at lightweight, it has been interesting because at featherweight he had a massive frame, but he still had really good volume. I think we're going to see even more of that volume game at lightweight and against a guy like Yagos, who, again, will throw a very high output, but can tire as the fight goes on. I think this fight's going to get really interesting, of course, in the first round, of course, in the second, but every minute that ticks off the clock, this fight should get even more interesting.
One guy fights like a hybrid Prius, the other guy fights like a gas-guzzling Hummer on empty for the last 50 miles, just gunning it. So, Matt, a couple of big-time fights, you let us know. I mean, 13 total fights on this card. You're not wrong till Saturday night. Let us know who you have in the fight of the night. Six ranked fighters on the card, on the main card. Lucinda Walker looking for their first wins in the UFC because they don't know how to place fights anymore. I mean, Royval Nicolau was on the prelims last weekend and everybody wondered just why. You look at it in terms of UFC debuts, it's kind of the true debut for Walker. It is the real UFC debut out of the Glory Kickboxing prodigy known as Junior Taffa. It's the juggernaut. He's taking on the motor, Muhammad Usman. And listen, Usman hasn't fought since he won the Ultimate Fighter season 30, that crazy knockout win over Zach Paunga. So a lot of fights kind of all over the place. Six ranked fighters on the card. One giant favorite, and that is Montel Jackson taking on the submission artist. My guy. Old creepy old walkie man. I mean, it's Ronnie Yaya.
Please don't call him old creepy ever again.
Ronnie Yaya, for stiff as he is, he's got over 20 submission wins in his pro career. So some big time fights on this one. Okay. And I know, again, this is one of those Fight Night Pick specials where we're breaking down some of these prelims in great detail with some fighters that you might not have heard of before.
I think there's a lot of really fun matchups on the card, though. Like, I'm really excited to break this one down.
All right, Matt. So we have a lot of fights to go down through. You guys came through in the clutch with the subs last week. If you're hesitant around touching that sub button, make sure you do. You get some of that late breaking news if any of these fights do change. Question mark kicks, which is always 2 hours before the prelims. You can find that here on the channel. We got a lot to talk about this week. You're going to want to keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. A clash of styles to kick off the prelims. Coming up this weekend, we have Mongolia Storm. Dana Bakari is going to be taking on Bam Bam Brady Heestan. And when you look at the overall career arc of both of these guys, put yourself in their shoes two fights ago. For Brady Heestan, he's going into the finale of The Ultimate Fighter against Ricky Tercios. He has a blood and guts type of fight of the night where he loses to split decision. Listen, some of those rounds were really chintzy. He got dropped at one point in the third round. But for Heestan, and that kind of is where it stands. For Bakari Dana, he was on a 3-fight knockout streak in the UFC after he lost Alatang Hei Li to make his debut. He's taking on Chris Gutierrez. He's the favorite against Chris Gutierrez. And then he gets finished in that fight. And then a couple of months afterwards, he replaces Simon Oliveira on short notice after switching up his training camp to Tiger Muay Thai. And then he ends up losing a kind of a close decision to Kyung Ho Gong. So for both of these guys, it is kind of a get-right fight. And I know for Heestan, that might sound a little odd, but his last time out, he did get wobbled by the first punch that Fernie Garcia threw in that one. He went out there with his wrestling shoes. He ended up going out there getting a great decision win. And for Heestan, that's kind of what he's known for. I know, you know, coming into The Ultimate Fighter, people looked at Heestan and they considered it okay. He's got some wins on the regional scene, tidy little amateur record, but as a pro, he had one loss to Chad Ann Heliger, who was 9-5 at the time. And Chad, turns out, pretty good fighter. He's in the UFC in his own right. But for Heestan, out of all of the wins before he came into the UFC, 0-24 combined opponent record. So
great.
Then he goes out there, he beats Josh Reddinghouse, and that's a really recognizable name over with M1 Global. He beats Vince Murdoch, finishes him in that one. Then he gets into the finale against Tercio. So a lot of those question marks around the record, they kind of get thrown out the door a little bit. And what do we know about Heestan? Well, as I said, trains at Sick Jitsu in the Pacific Northwest, and you'll see those influences in training, and I'll throw some pictures up there for Heestan. Training for this camp out of Sick Jitsu, cross training over at Syndicate with Michael Chiesa, with Vince Murdoch, or sorry, Vince Morales, who we're going to talk about later on in this card, because a little bit of give and take there with a guy like Ricky Simone, who trains out of ATT Portland. But for Heestan, a lot of wrestlers, a lot of noted fighters in those corners. And when you look at a guy like Heestan at only 23, he continues to kind of evolve his game and mix his martial arts when he fights.
He definitely does, but that's something that kind of worries me in this fight. I like the fact that he is so well-rounded and the fact that he is starting to mix in his boxing with his wrestling a lot more effectively. But on the other hand, Dana does throw a high variety of strikes, and although he might not be the highest level of striker, he's unorthodox with the way that he can throw hooks. He is a very long-range striker with the way that he can use his boxing, and I do think that there's a world, I told you this before we started filming, I think there is a world where Tanaka go in there and get a knockout in the first round and look really impressive, because he does move his feet very well for being a primary striker. And what's something we always say on this channel? It's not just a thing to have great takedown defense and dig underhooks, but if you have great footwork, that does help you evade some of the initial takedown attempts of your opponent, and I do think Dana has the type of footwork that can help him avoid some of the initial takedowns of Brady Heestand, but it will be interesting to see how Heestand tries to close the distance, because if he does go in there using his boxing combinations like we have seen in the past, I don't know if he has the durability to stand up to the combinations of a guy like Dana, because Bakary might be able to get hit on the chin, you can wobble him. If you're a really high level striker, you'll be able to give him issues, because you might be able to out-technique him, but I don't think Heestand's going to be able to stand in this fight a lot. I'm sure he's going to use his boxing to try to open up his wrestling at a certain point, but I really do think that wrestling is the thing that's going to give him the majority of his success in the matchup, because I think he's going to struggle on the feet. Like you've said, even in fights that he's won, he has had a susceptibility to getting tagged on the feet, and against a guy like Bakary, he has that real kind of power where if he hurts you, he's not just going to let you get off the leash after that. He's going to pursue you and try to finish you afterwards.
Bakary, out of his takedown defense numbers, I mean, he's 3-3 in the UFC, so it's a decent level sample size, but he defended, 4 of 7 total takedown attempts from Alatang Hei Li in that one. That was actually a fight of the night in his debut. He defended, he went 0 of 2 against Kyung Ho Gong. So I guess Gong went 0 of 2, sort of that 66% takedown defense for Bakary Dana. But you look at those knockout wins, and he won 3 fights in a row. He looked amazing in them. He goes out there and he beats Guido Canetti. It was a lead left hook knockout, and he floored him. Canetti was on Beat Street, as we now say. So in that one, a great win. Guido Canetti recently retired. He beats Kevin Natividad, lands a good right hand. The left hook is what stops him. And then there's about 5 unanswered shots after that one. Kevin Natividad out of the UFC. And then he takes on Brandon Davis. Performance bonus, Brandon Davis. No longer in the UFC. So anybody that Bakary Dana has beaten is out of the UFC, and anybody that he's lost to is still in the UFC. So it's a little bit of a seesaw there with the record of a guy like Bakary Dana. We know how good the striking is. We know how good that lead left hook knockout can be when he's fighting from the orthodox stance. He will switch his stance a little bit, but I talk about the training camps out of both of these guys, and for Bakary Dana, that's where it really gets interesting, because as I said, for that Kyung Ho Gong fight, it was right after getting knocked out by Gutierrez. He switched it up to Tiger Muay Thai out of Thailand. For this one, Fight Ready MMA training with old foe, Alatang Hei Li.
Love that.
But out of it, Alatang Hei Li, Shaymon Moraes, Julia Budd, Lance Gibson, they both lost recently. But when you do look at it,
not in their primes, I think that's fair to say.
Lance Gibson is. Lance Gibson Jr.
Sorry, Julia Budd, though.
Senior, no, but Gibson, yes. Exactly. But when you look at it, too, for Bakary Dana, he is a part of the Brazilian contingent there with Eric Albarracin, Henry Cejudo, Costa, Patricky Pitbull. So you do like to see those guys and those looks. And I assume there's probably a lot of wrestling going on in that room. And I would think a perfect guy to emulate the style of a guy like Brady Heestand, who was supposed to be on the next pay-per-view, but it was just announced that he fell out, is a guy like JSP, Jonathan Pierce, a long-rangey boxer who mixes in those long-rangey takedown attempts. So I really like this fight. The story of it for me is, of course, the wrestling of a guy like Heestand.
Exactly.
And the power striking of a guy like Bakary Dana. Bakary is favored in the matchup, Matt. And I'll give you the point after we have a look at the topology votes. Surprise to us, they are to you. I'm going to say over-under. I think it's going to be close. I'm going to say over-under 62.5% for Bakary in this.
I think they'll be over, but just slightly.
Just slightly? 71% going with Bakary Dana. 79% by knockout. For the 29% that have Heestand, 74% by decision.
So the only point I wanted to make was, I think we both agree, Heestand has all the skills to win this by decision. I really do think he does. I think he can mix up his boxing in with his wrestling and go out there and just put a pace on Dana that maybe he can't keep up with, to where he can effectively strike Heestand to kind of make up for the difference that the control of his wrestling would make. But I still think the variety of strikes that Dana can throw on the outside is going to be a little bit too much for Heestand. If Brady goes out there and wins the decision, I'll be more than happy to eat my words, because it will be nice to see a prospect who is only 23, who, like you said, seems to make those improvements, go out there and get a real meaningful win. But I do think does just have the slight edge in striking. I do think that'll get it done for him.
I mean, for Heestand, he started a kind of incorporate a little bit of a Dominic Cruz to his style, where he'll figure eight on the outside to try and land some of those single shots. He switches stances quite a bit in his own right, or at least he has as he's come along. And what we saw out of him in his last fight, again, some single shots, the reset, and then he gets out of space, throws the double leg out there, and if he's able to get it, he has some really good top pressure in these fights. And Fernie Garcia is no slouch. That's a really good win that Stan was able to get his last time out there. Odds were pretty close in the fight. I'll go with Bakary Dana because I do like the power in his fights, and I like the fact that even at 33, he's not necessarily shop-worn, and he tends to have good output as his fights go on. So both of us going with Mongolia's Storm, Bakary Dana, to get the win in the matchup. Let us know down below in the comments section who you have will be the Ultimate Fighter runner-up, Bam Bam Stan. Will it be Storm, Bakary? Some big time fights left on this card. Matt, co-main event, 135. Song Yadong taking on one tricky fighter from the Pacific Northwest in Ricky Simone. Main event, Pavlovich versus Blades. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. With a combined 22 wins by finish, these flyweights don't know a boring fight. They're both Brazilian, and we have the zombie girl Priscila Cachoeira taking on, it's so aggressive, killer Karine Silva. And when you look at this one, Matt, I mean, Cachoeira is the one that kind of holds that load of the decision win. I mean, Karine Silva has never won a fight by decision. She's
Priscilla's
never
got that power, though.
Gone that way. And when you do look at this matchup, Matt, a couple of very interesting gyms. I mean, Gile Ribeiro team, or Ribeiro team, for Karine Silva. You know them for Rogério Bontarin, as well as Augusto Sakai earlier on in his career. For Cachoeira, she's switching things up. And I'm going to say this with a little bit of an asterisk. This is her second camp at MMA Master. She was supposed to take on Sajara Eubanks earlier on this year. Eubanks out a day before the weigh-ins, so Cachoeira has to go back to the drawing board. So it is two full camps out of South Florida. And if you look at it for Cachoeira, a couple of big wins in a row. Second to last was a fight of the night where she got her purple belt at the Apex.
Weird.
Went on a victory speech like Halle Berry for Monsters Ball. And then her last time out, she beats Ariane Lipsky by finishing the first round. And listen, Lipsky extenuating circumstances are what they are. You're going to look at that win in the win column being by first round, throw those rose-colored glasses on and go, wow, like, that's a giant win. And it is a big win.
I just think Priscilla, this is what Priscilla is to me. She's that, do you have that dog in you test? Because she is extremely aggressive, has top tier punching power.
If they do the x-rays in the Twitter picture, are there pit bulls in her chest?
Without a doubt, Priscilla's full of them. But that's the thing about Priscilla. She's going to offer you very obvious skill checks that, again, if you aren't really a top tier prospect, you're probably not going to meet them because you're going to face adversity when you fight Priscila Cachoeira. You're not just going to eat a couple of strikes, take her down, and that's it. Yes, she has been susceptible to the
takedown. Jillian Robertson did it.
Exactly. Like, no, she has an Achilles heel being the takedown defense and the grappling, but you're going to eat strikes for it. She does have oddly decent cardio and decent punching power late into fights. I just like what she does offer a lot of prospects on their way up, and that's why I really do enjoy this fight, because Karina Silva has been a very impressive prospect. You look at her finishing ability, you look at her very technical striking from the outside, and you think, okay, she has a very clear pathway to win this fight. But on the other hand, if Priscilla just puts her head down, gets that high guard going, and marches forward, there is a world where her accumulation starts to wear on Silva, and it's kind of like what we just saw with Joe Joyce over the weekend. Joe Joyce is a pretty hyped up heavyweight, right? Everybody loved Joe Joyce, and then all of a sudden, he's susceptible to pressure. His eye starts popping up, and Joe Joyce, he can't fight anymore. It's over the sixth round. I just think Priscilla is a great fighter to offer any of these plus level prospects.
And for Silva, I mean, a Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu brown belt, you see her out there working in the gi for Cachoeira, as mentioned. I mean, a purple belt if we've ever seen one. But when you do look at this fight, Matt, it's really interesting. I mean, for Cachoeira, she's 1-1 fighting in Vegas. She's 1-0 at the Apex. She got that win over Gian Kim. For Karine Silva, 2-0 at the Apex. She gets the win on Dana White's Contender Series 2021 over Yan Kihui. Gets a submission win. Looked good in the first round. Really tired in the second round, gets a submission win.
If she starts to feel the pace of Priscilla, this fight could get ugly.
And Silva's last time out, a really quick finish win over Pollyanna Battaglio. Happy trails, we'll see you outside of the UFC. Yeah. So for Silva, again, she has all of those finish wins, 9 by knockout, 6 by submission. And if you do consider it, I mean, Cachoeira tied for second all-time in flyweight knockout wins with 2. with 2. Valentina Shevchenko, number 1, with 4. Not a lot of knockout wins in the women's flyweight division. But, Matt, when we do consider this fight, Silva, a minus 165 or thereabout favorite. Cachoeira, plus 135 underdog. We have a look at the Tapology vote. Surprise to us as they are to you. I'm going to say over, under 65% Karina Silva.
Under.
I'm going to say under. It's way over. 670 total votes, 83% Silva, 74% by submission for the 17% that have Cachoeira, 55% by decision, 31% by the knockout. So the fans of Karina Silva, and I should say this, Matt, her striking is very good. It's the forefront of her game.
Good.
Nice tie stance, nice tie guard. But again, I just wonder about if you have somebody that presses a pace against her, how's her cardio going to hold up? If you look at Silva, she's never won a fight by decision. And you look at two finishers, it's hard to project a decision win. But it tends to happen more often than not at the women's flyweight division. So I do have a hard time with this fight, not necessarily breaking it down in the most analytical stance. But for me, I do have a hard time trying to pick a winner.
And I don't think the underdog pick is a bad pick by any means. Because again, Cachoeira is an obvious kind of skill check for a lot of these prospects on the way up. Remember we talked about this with Greg Hardy when he first came over to the UFC? It was, hey, he doesn't have a lot of MMA experience, so every opponent he faces, he's going to face kind of the cardio skill check and the leg kick skill check. You're going to offer all these different opponents on your way up. And for Silva, you're going to face someone who's going to really rough you up in this matchup. So it will come down to how comfortable can Silva be in some of these exchanges. I thought I was going to pick Priscilla going into this video, if I'm being completely honest, but ever so slightly, I will pick Silva. I think if everything's equal on the feet, I will give her the slight edge on the mat if it does end up going there. So again, I'm going to openly say this. Priscilla could win this on the feet. She's a very damaging striker. We've seen this before, but ever so slightly, I'll go with Silva.
I have Karina Silva based on those ground skills, but when you look at a matchup like this, another camp for Cachoeira out of MMA Masters with Daniel Valverde, they know how to train strikers to then get pretty darn 100%. Good with the defensive grappling skills. So both of us going with Killer Silva in the matchup, like Killer Kowalski. Co-main event, Song Yadong versus Ricky Simone. Main event, Pavlovich taking on Blades. You let us know down below in the comment section who you have in these fights. Keep it locked in with Fight Name Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
Prospect versus prospect banger coming up on the prelims this weekend at featherweight. We have Francis Fire Marshall welcoming Francis William Jaguar Gomez to the United States of America. And when you look at it for William Gomez, this is his first fight in North America, and it's only his second fight outside of Europe. He got a big win with UAE Warriors before he was able to kind of round things out on the regional scene, end up in the UFC. And it was on a few weeks' notice that they announced William Gomez's debut at UFC Paris, where he was going to be taking on Jarno Ahrens. And Gomez getting ready for a fight out of MMA Factory. Ahrens, he was getting ready for a fight in his own right. They threw those two guys together. Gomez was a minus 225 favorite in the matchup, but as we said getting ready for that one, we were different on the pick, but we said it's going to be a really close fight. And out of it, I know it's a majority decision win for Gomez. I scored it 30-27 for Gomez, but it was a really close
a competitive 30-27.
It really was, and you got to learn a lot about both guys. I know Ahrens has a debut coming up. They originally had a matchup against David Onama at the end of last year, coming into January, but when you look at a matchup like this, Matt, I had so much to say about Gomez going into that debut. His cousin is a guy that's got a fight coming up in the very near future, or sorry, his uncle is Gregory Baben, and Baben's got a fight coming up on that Bellator Paris card that's headlined by Gegard Mousasi and Fabian Edwards. You know I'm watching that one. But when you look at a guy like Gomez, at 13, he found Sande, became a junior national champ in France, and he was able to parlay that into this wonderful MMA career. And look at Gomez's last loss. Morgan Charrière, who was the champ over with Cage Warriors, that's a pretty darn good fighter. Yes. So he's riding a giant win streak. And if you consider it for both of these guys, 13, I mean, like that was a coming of age for both of them. Gomez found Sanda, Francis Marshall found Kurt Pellegrino, and then he became a great mixed martial artist, got into wrestling in high school, and then of course, I mean, starts that MMA turn as an amateur, undefeated as a pro, picked up his first win in the UFC's octagon, a finish over Marcelo Rojo, always the nail, never the hammer.
That's
Marcelo
the thing.
Rojo.
Who was, I forget his name. Who did everybody knock out? He was in a bunch of fight of the nights, though. He was like 9-9 by the end of it. He fought Drew Dober. I can't remember, and that's unfortunate, but that's the name of Francis Marshall. His last fight, you might be buying a little bit high on him based off that last fight, but it is interesting. I really like the striking of William Gomez. I like his 1-2.
Okay, hold on. We have to get this out of the way right now. William Gomez fights like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Some fights he's on the back foot,
yeah,
and doesn't throw much. Some fights he's moving forward, he's throwing that body
but
kick.
The thing is,
he's holding his hands like he's riding a chopper.
He needs a very specific range to have a lot of success, is my overarching point, though. He is a guy who has to have that distance to really have success in his game, and that's where Marshall can completely take advantage of it, because he is a fighter who can mix in his wrestling and his boxing very well, especially for being a prospect with only 7 fights on his record. That's the thing with both these guys. I expect them both to make massive gains in between every single fight, because they are in their mid-20s, early 20s, so I do think we will see massive improvements out of both guys, but for William, I love the striking on the outside. The thing is, if you do make it ugly, if you put your head in his chest, use boxing combinations, dirty box him, use your wrestling, you can have a ton of success, but the problem is, you're going to eat a lot of damage on the way in. But like you said, there is that switch of William to where, when he's moving forward, throwing the combination, throwing the body kick, and his body kick is beautiful, I couldn't agree anymore with you. It is great, and he's working at kind of 100% efficiency, but if he's on the back foot, kind of just looking for the big shot, reminiscent of Uriah Hall kind of midway through in the latter half of his career, I think he will really have difficulty with the pressure of Marshall.
When I look at a guy like Gomez, and we talked about that in the debut, it's that, okay, this guy has flashy striking, he had that great fight against Harila, who's like a superstar with Cage Warriors, and every time they bring him back, they announce it in an email. But when you look at a guy like Gomez, they said, okay, as good as he is as a striker, wrestling's at the forefront of his game. We saw that against Jarno Ahrens, who's a very accredited judo player. Gomez was the one that was getting the takedown. Gomez, even out of the head and arm throws, and Jarno landed one good one, Gomez was able to scramble out of the position, end up on top, and land some good shots. And in that fight, I mean, back and forth first round, I thought Gomez had the second, I thought Gomez had the third. I scored a 30-27. Judge Christophe Chaput scored a round 3. 10-10. Christophe, qu'est-ce qu'on fait, mon gars? Like, why? You never see 10-10s, but in France, you do. So
I'm okay with it.
A very competitive fight for Gomez. And for Marshall, he ends up on Dana White's Contender Series last year. He fights Connor Matthews. And in that one, he withstood a lot of adversity in the first round. He kind of got hit a little bit. Second round, third round, he's able to bite down on the mouthpiece, work in his own game, work in his takedowns. And against a guy like Rojo, that right hand was there for him just about every time. He controlled every aspect. And at the end of it, he put Rojo on, as we say, beat street. But out of both of these guys,
Marco Polo Reyes, that was the name I was looking for.
Matt.
Remember him at the end? Marco Polo Reyes, if he hit you, you were going down. But if you hit him, he was also going down.
I have a prop in this one. You want to talk about remember him and remember when. For both of these guys, when we look at the level of competition, for Marshall, it was kind of all over the place coming into the UFC. Beat Mike Taylor, was 3-2. Ray Trujillo, who fought everybody, who was 24-30 at the time. And Michael Lawrence, who was 7-6 before. Marshall fought 5-0 Connor Matthews. But William Gomez, before he ended up in the UFC, before he ended up fighting Jose Marcos on Aries, he wasn't originally due to take on Jose Marcos. Matt, remember who William Gomez was supposed to fight. Is this the most embarrassing $10 purchase I've ever made? My guy, Matt, William Gomez was supposed to fight the legend.
Oh, God.
Henan Barão. I mean, look at that. Just great stuff right there.
One of the few fighters who was forced to defend an interim title.
It's BS. Like it's Tony Ferguson or Kevin Lee. But, Matt, when you look at a matchup like this, William Gomez, that slick striker from the outside, he was a -225 and he won his debut. Now he's the underdog making his American debut. Gomez, the underdog. The favorite is Francis Fire Marshall. Almost a 2-1 favorite is Marshall. We have a look at the topology vote. Surprise to us there, to you. I'm going to say Kurt Pellegrino's pupil is favored. I'm going to say over under 75% Francis Marshall.
I think it'll be over, and I'll say why after.
Oh, my goodness gracious. 670 total votes. 76% Marshall. 72% by decision for the 24% that have Gomez. 75% by decision. If they strike on the outside, William Gomez rides that bike and beats Francis Marshall by decision. Gomez is a really good wrestler. If you can't tell, Ivan, it's a little bit of a toss-up, but you have some big pros for Marshall as well.
I just think the range is going to be a big X factor in this fight, because for Gomez, even his wrestling does come a lot from sort of those clinch exchanges, sort of the scrambles, and I don't think Marshall's going to be that loose on top with his wrestling exchanges, and that's why I do think the pressure of Marshall's going to be such a big X factor in this fight. So, for me, I do have Francis Marshall. I think his boxing and his wrestling is going to be able to disguise each other enough to have a decent amount of success, but still, I was very high on Gomez coming into the UFC. I love his striking. I even like his grappling ability, but again, I think the heaviness of Marshall on top is just going to make it difficult for Gomez to really scramble and have effective grappling off his back.
Marshall has to find his way into his fights, and that's 100%. A little bit scary. His striking's coming a long way, but his striking defense isn't matching the offense that he is throwing, because he throws a really nice 1-2, punctuates it with a big right hand, and again, Kurt Pellegrino, what was he known for in the UFC? Submission ability and takedowns. You know that Francis Marshall has that. Out of all of these wins, what is it? 4 by submission, rear naked chokes are all out there.
He's a strong fighter.
And he did an interview with Sports Key to MMA, and I'm going to talk about James Lynch quite a bit on these, but the quote that I got out of the interview that he did with Lynch, camp's going great, so I was actually wrestling a lot more in between fights, and then now in this camp, I've been wrestling still. My wrestling coach is Daniel Cohn. Drilling partners Connor Mallett and then Anthony Santaniello, who's his girlfriend's brother, and he's a high school state wrestling champ, current high school state wrestling champ. So Francis Marshall's working a ton of the wrestling. I don't know. I didn't hear any conversation about whether or not he's still involved in firefighting, because he still was before his last fight. In this matchup, I'll ever so slightly go with Francis Marshall. But again, as an underdog, William Gomez is a great pick. On the outside, he's great. Defending takedowns, he's very good. We'll see who's able to get the win. I think the sharp pick is probably William Gomez, but I'm not sharp lately. I'm dull as a butter knife, and I'm going with Francis Marshall. We're in agreement on the pick. We have some big-time fights left on this card. Pavlovich is taking on Blaydes in the main event. You're not going to want to miss. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say,
let's get into it.
Heavyweight finishers clash in a battle of the Hey Brothers.
Hey Brothers.
In Vegas, Matt, coming up this weekend, we have the Ultimate Fighter Season 30 winner, Muhammad the Motor Usman, taking on the former pro kickboxer, currently 4-0 in MMA, all in 2022. I'm talking about the Juggernaut Junior Taffa. And Matt, a lot of people excited about the UFC debut of a guy like Junior Taffa, but if I back it up a little bit, for Muhammad Usman, I'm gonna play something. You hear that wind?
I do.
The wind and the time. It's passed Muhammad Usman by since the last time that we saw him. It was way back in the summer of last year when he got that win over Zach Paunga to finish off and punctuate a season of the Ultimate Fighter that, if I may say, was a little lackluster. But when you look at a guy like Muhammad Usman, I mean, his second to last pro fight was against Brandon Sales over at the PFL. He gets knocked down twice in that one, gets submitted and choked out completely. He was asleep. And then he goes on the season of the Ultimate Fighter, fights Saip, gets a decision win, goes out there, gets another decision win. But if you do look at it overall for Usman, I mean, I even threw the numbers down there and wrote them down just to be specific. He threw hardly any strikes in that fight against Paunga before he landed that crazy left hook knockout. And listen, the YouTubers, they were out there, they were throwing out their clickbaity titles, they were trying to get people to say that that was one of the biggest knockouts last year.
I don't know about that.
And I mean, it won a title, an Ultimate Fighter title.
Leon knocked out his brother, though? That was a lot bigger.
It was. But when you do look at this fight overall, Matt, for Muhammad Usman, definitely has the edge in the MMA experience. It's easy to say, but for Taffa, 4-0 in pro MMA all last year. He got a big win his last time out there against a former sumo wrestler. And I'll break down all the matchups, and I'll talk a little bit about Junior Taffa's time as a pro kickboxer, because he faced some of the world's best, not named Rico Verhoeven or Badr Hari or Alistair Overeem. But at one point, as a 22-year-old, Junior Taffa was the 5th-ranked heavyweight in Glory Kickboxing. So crazy, crazy story there for Taffa. But when you look at both of these guys, Matt, primary strikers in MMA,
yeah,
both came into MMA from other disciplines, and very notable for Muhammad Usman, he was a defensive lineman at University of Arizona. And just overall, I mean, it's crazy to say, A, two brothers won the Ultimate Fighter. Older Usman, being Kamaru, he won season 21. Muhammad won season 30. But a long time away for Usman. And if you look at it on his socials, I haven't seen any training footage. Like, he posted one kind of preamble video, like a hype video for this fight happening. And then he posted a picture of his dad's birthday. And then he posted a picture that he's an OnlyFans athlete. So I don't know what to make of it for Muhammad Usman and the long layoff since he won the season.
Neither guy's ever fighting for the UFC title. I don't want to be that negative, but like, neither guy has the depth to their game that you expect is going to build this crazy foundation, and then they're going to become these well-rounded athletes that'll beat guys
like Stipe.
You don't
like people to watch your videos, do you?
Well, just sometimes you got to be really honest to the people who do watch them and who stick through for Muhammad Usman and Junior Taffa, because I don't think a lot of people are looking at the thumbnail, looking at these guys, thinking, wow, I'm probably going to start watching UFC because Muhammad Usman and Junior Taffa. I just think this matchup is interesting because it will be a low-volume affair, I do think, because of
where such a stupid take.
No, hear me out. Usman's a guy who is going to fight from very far on the outside, and he does move very well laterally in this matchup, so hear me out. When he lunges in for some of those bigger strikes, I think it's going to be he either lands or he eats big power, and I do think he's going to be hesitant, really jumping into the pocket. Not that I discount what Taffa can do on the feet, because I do think Taffa is the far more well-rounded striker out of these two guys, but I think Usman's going to be really hesitant jumping in and really trying to initiate a lot of these exchanges because Taffa is so dangerous from the outside. So I think you've got me mistaken. It's not that I think Usman's going to be able to have a lot of success in the feet. I just don't know if he's going to be really willing to engage in that pocket and throw more than just one or two strikes because Taffa is a lot more dangerous. And like you've said, Usman's a guy who's been hurt multiple occasions in matchups. And Taffa, he has good single shot power, but once he does get rolling downhill, he can put combinations on you. So if he's able to hurt a guy like Usman, I would imagine Taffa's able to finish the job and get him out of there after he's initially able to get him hurt if that situation does come up.
I've seen Taffa build at different heights, whether it was Glory, whether it was in MMA, so he could be 6'3", he could be 6'5". We'll see these two guys square off on Friday after the weigh-ins, assuming we make it to that. But if you look at it, going by the Glory numbers, Muhammad Usman has a 6-inch reach advantage, and we'll see if he's able to do that, because for Usman in his fights, he kind of paused like a long step-in jab, and he'll throw it to the body, he'll throw it to the head, he throws a really big lunging overhand right, and he throws that left hook, like he knocked out Zach Paunga. Not a big leg kicker, and he's got some of the bigger legs you're going to find in this heavyweight division, but for Junior Taffa, again, he turned pro in MMA last July, and he already has 4 knockout wins. And if you look at the level of competition, it's kind of all over the place. Like the first pro fight, he takes on Taisi Sakino, and in that one, I mean, Sakino, he's one of those guys that kind of fought not really the greatest level of competition. He goes in there, blitzes him, drops him once, he gets back up, and he drops him again. He goes out there and he fights a guy who's fought everybody, and Kevin Fitzial, who's 15-12-2 at the time, but Fitzial had fought like really, really, really big names up until that point. I know one of them was Rakeem Cleveland. I know he had some wins over some good guys, some losses to some good guys. That fight was all over the place. Fitzial was able to go out there, get some takedowns. Taffa was able to knock him down in that one. Taffa then goes out and he fights Nicholas Djurjevic over with Brave. And in that one, Djurjevic runs across the cage, gets the takedown, and Taffa's in really compromised positions to start that one. He ends up somehow getting back up to his feet, lands an uppercut, drops his opponent, gets in top control, lands a ground and pound. And his last time he takes on, see, I'm trying to sound like I'm from Australia, takes on Tiyoshi Sudario, who's a guy that wasn't allowed to be a sumo wrestler anymore because he hit a couple of clubbies like in and around some of the fights, allegedly, but he was forced to withdraw from being a pro sumo fighter. Was a decent pro MMA fighter, but in that one, it was the leg kicks, it was those long range attacks out of a guy like Taffa. And then I went down through and I watched some of these, Glory kickboxing bouts that he had. Because as a kickboxer, 23-5 with 19 knockout wins was Taffa. And the leg kicks are great. The uppercuts are great. The mixing from the body up to the head are some of the better weapons that he has. But out of even some of the losses and in the tournaments that he was a part of with Glory, he takes on Jamal Ben Sadiq. And if you know Ben Sadiq,
he's very good.
He's very good. He ended up being a champ and fighting Rico Verhoeven.
Had a crazy fight with Rico, yeah.
The way that fight went, early on in it, Taffa's cut falls out. And then he's got to put it back in. And then it falls out again. And the referee says, if this happens one more time, this is the end of the fight. You can see Taffa continuing to try and adjust it. And out of it, I mean, some really kind of close to the belt strikes by Ben Sadiq. And it ends up, that's how Taffa ends up getting finished. And Taffa's also fought, and I want to make sure I get it right, Ajibayi. And in that one, he's a guy that had fought and trained with Verhoeven. It was supposed to be Guto Inocenci who had beaten Taffa, but in the same night, Inocenci couldn't continue due to the cut. So Toff ends up taking the fight, and he gets his legs kicked completely out from under him. He's dropped or knocked down three times due to the leg kicks, so he doesn't win. He lost to some of the better kickboxers over with Glory when he was 22, 23 years old. He's progressed to this point as an MMA fighter under the tutelage of Mark Hunt and his brother, Justin Toffa. So if I call Junior Justin throughout this video, I apologize. It's just, when I watch Toffa fight in MMA, his overall kickboxing skill set translates better to MMA than I think is even his brother Justin's does. And I think Junior Toffa has a pretty darn high ceiling in this fight and in overall MMA, as long as he can work some of that takedown defense, because as I said, Dragicevic was able to run across the cage and take him down, and that fight was about 4 months ago.
I struggle with this fight, and I said it earlier. I think the big actions are going to be few and far between. I really do. I think Usman's going to fight this a hesitant fight, and we can disagree on that. That's fine. I just don't know how willing Usman's going to be to get in that pocket and really go for things, and this is what I mean. On the outside, he's going to be hesitant, and all the way on the inside, he's probably going to be going for a lot of takedowns. If he gets them, it's not like Usman's Damian Maia on the mat. It's going to be a lot of heavy control on top and not a lot of big actions, so that's why I have a hard time with this fight. I think Toffa easily has enough power to knock out Usman without a doubt, but honestly, vice versa, the same thing has to be said for Usman. He is a big and powerful enough athlete to where if he lands clean, he can definitely stop and finish a guy like Taffa. I just struggle with a lot of the in-betweens on this matchup because I'm not sure what we're going to see.
Boxing and Muay Thai experience for Taffa, his line over with Glory was 7.98 strikes landed per minute to 11.21 received, and his average fight time was 4 minutes and 16 seconds.
You love that.
They were over quick. And if you do consider, I mean, for Toffa, that lead uppercut's a big weapon, but he'll throw it from either arm. He'll throw it from either stance. He'll switch his stances too. And he tends to pace himself well in kickboxing, but in MMA, we haven't really seen it because the fights have been over very, very early. And Fitzial, as I mentioned, he had fought Rico Rodriguez. He was 1-1 against Ben Sassoli and 1-1 against one Roky Martinez, who is in the UFC as well. So when you look at the odds, Matt, Junior Toffa is favored in the matchup against the guy who just won the Ultimate Fighter in Muhammad Usman. If you look at it for a guy like Usman, he's been off for quite some time. I guess they are pretty close. Usman opened as a favorite. He's now, you know, kind of around par. So both these guys at par. I misspoke. When you have a look at the Tapology votes, I have no idea where they're going to be. I'm going to let you set the line.
I'll say Taffa is plus
65% over under. I'm going to say over for Junior Taffa, and it's over. So 678 total votes, 74% going Taffa, 89% by knockout for the 26% that have Usman, 69% by knockout. The trouble I have with this one, Matt, is Usman last four fights sales. He lands 28 of 67 total strikes. In two rounds. He was low output against Saip in a really close fight. He was low output in his next matchup on The Ultimate Fighter against a man in Eduardo Perez. Both those guys were number one overall picks on that season. Usman was Team Pena. You heard that from the soundbite. Perez was Team Nunes. He wins that one by a very close decision. And then he goes out there against Paunga. Doesn't throw anything in the first round. And then the second round, he gets the knockout. And I had Usman to beat Paunga. And I was surprised as anybody when he landed that knockout blow. For me, Junior Toffa walks across the cage, respects the power, and I think he goes in there and gets a finish win over Muhammad Usman. I think it's a night and day with the striking, and Usman isn't a big wrestler like his brother. So for me, I like Junior Toffa in the matchup. It's almost like my pick of Iwan Kutsalaba last week, which is one of the few I got right.
I'll hitch my wagon to how confident you are with Junior Toffa. I also agree with the pick.
No, it's pop and popcorn if it's anything. Too big.
I don't know. You just
strikers.
Said he was going to walk across and finish the guy, so you seem pretty confident. So yeah, that doesn't seem pop and popcorn when you predict a finish. So I'm going to say Junior Toffa. Again, I do think he is the more technical striker, and I think he can make Usman pay for some those in-betweens on the outside. But again, if Usman does make this a boring fight, uses the clinch control, really does create a lot of just destroys, I guess, the separation in this fight and eliminates some of the kicks and the combinations of Taffa, I can see Usman having success, but I'll have Taffa in the matchup.
We'll have a look. A couple of powerful strikers at heavyweight, both of us going with the juggernaut Junior Taffa making his UFC debut. He became a pro mixed martial artist last summer. Less than a year ago. So a big time fight on this card. Main event also in this division. Pavlovich taking on Blades. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Ranked bantamweights meeting up at featherweight coming up this weekend. We have Carol Hosa changing it up and going up to 145. Taking on the immortal Norma Dumont. And if you're somebody that really likes the UFC rankings, give your head a shake. Norma Dumont's had one fight at bantamweight in her UFC career in 2020 against Ashley Evans-Smith. Dumont weighed 139.5, won that fight, dropped Evans-Smith at the end of the third round, and that's her only bantamweight win, and she's ranked in this division. Every other fight's been at featherweight. She missed featherweight in one of them at 146.5, won that fight. So for Norma Dumont, a big-time opportunity here against a legit bantamweight at featherweight in Carol Hossa. And for Hossa, much better level of competition in her overall pro career. I know she had a few losses and bumps and bruises on the regional scene, including a featherweight loss to somebody who was coming out of the UFC, and I'm talking about Larissa Pacheco. That was kind of a get-right fight for Pacheco after losing to Jermaine Durandamy. She beats a regional Carol Hossa, and things are back and going well. But for Hossa, it should be noted, that's her only loss at featherweight. She's actually 2-1 career at featherweight. So an interesting choice for Hossa to move up to 145 for this fight against Norma Dumont, who in my mind feels like a true featherweight. Like, she fills out well in this division.
She's a one of one, I guess.
She really is a unicorn. And for Dumont, her last time out, I mean, it was like she won the Stanley Cup, the NBA Finals, and a World Series title her last time out. She fought Danielle Wolfe. I credit her with like 3 knockdowns, and I know I say like, but like, she beat Danielle Wolfe quite handily, but that was a 1-0 former.
What does
pro
this
boxer.
Fight do for either fighter, it, though, Craig? I'm it sorry. Does. It's just like, 145 is such a weird position for me, because what are we fighting for right now? The opportunity to get mopped by Amanda Nunes? Like, I'm sorry, but like, if Norma Dumont fought Amanda Nunes, you know what my prediction on that fight is? It's over in the first round.
I don't understand this.
No, it's just odd matchmaking.
Well, let's break it down little bit stylistically, Matt. Norma Dumont, Sanda background.
Good Muay Thai.
If you look at it, so Sanda, Chinese kickboxing, that's really where she gets it done. That is her bread and butter. She trains out of a very good team as well, out of Gracie Barra Pompeia, and she is a Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu brown belt. So the black belt in Sanda. The Jiu-Jitsu, it's gotten some work. I'd say Carol Hossa a little bit more well-schooled there, coming out of PRVT, and she has that lineage to Dee Gomes, who picked up a big knockout win last week over Bruno Brazil. So Hossa looking to just continue that role for PRVT. And Hossa, in her last two fights in 2022, it was bad. I mean, she was Sarah McMahon's meal ticket to a payday with Bellator. That's real. Sarah McMahon, 41 years old, beat Carol Hossa with takedowns and then went and took that bag over to Scott Coker's Bellator. And Hossa's last time out against Lena Landsberg, loses the first round, lands an illegal knee, and loses a point in the second round. So it's a 9-9 Hossa round. Round 3, 10-9 Hossa, ends up as a draw. You would think, so Matt, Carol Hossa, a chintzy decision winner last time out. I don't know what to expect out of Carol Hossa at featherweight. For Norma Dumont, it's a lot of basic boxing combinations, a big 1-2.
Looping strikes, though.
Big 1-2, big 1-2, and steadiness, whereas Carol Hossa, I've seen her set like near record numbers at bantamweight in her Laura Fritzen debut. And some of these fights that Hossa has where it's primary striking battles, look at it. She retired Betch Kohea.
But that's in the back of my mind. What if Norma just puts on the wrestling shoes? Like, not that Carol Hossa can't deal with someone who has the wrestling of Norma Dumont. Like, not that Dumont is a Sarah McMahon, but you understand what I mean. The Achilles heel of Carol Hossa is a lot of control. She's not a great clinch fighter from an underhooks position. I don't want to say like Dominic Cruz too much, but you get the idea. Fighters can control her from that position. And I do think Norma Dumont, with her wrestling background, or at least grappling in her back pocket, I could see her going out there and using the wrestling and the grappling to her benefit. But Hossa's knees at the middle, I think, are going to be a big X factor in this matchup. I like Norma Dumont striking, but the thing is, she does loop a lot of her strikes. And what have we learned time after time after time? Straight shots beat looping strikes basically every single time. And Carol Hossa throws more accurate strikes than Norma Dumont. And I do think that's why she is the favorite in this matchup. Because when I originally looked at this, I know we normally talk about the odds at the end, but still. When I looked at this fight, I thought Dumont was going to be a favorite. You know, she has more experience at 145. In my mind's eye, she was the bigger fighter, but the more I started thinking about it, if Dumont doesn't have a ton of success from that kind of middle to outside range, what is she going to do outside of the takedowns? I think she will struggle in some of the more pure boxing exchanges in this fight.
I mean, if you do look at it for Hossa, the former favela combat featherweight champ back in 2018, and you talked about the numbers, I'd like to talk about them because we have a decent sample size here. Norma Dumont got knocked out by that right cross against Megan Anderson, making her UFC debut. The only other loss for Dumont was a really close decision against Macy Chasson. It was the striking of Dumont. It was the takedowns of Chasson in that one. But analytically, 6.14 strikes landed per minute for Hossa favors her over Dumont to 3.64. 4.11 strikes absorbed per minute to Hossa, 2.04 to Dumont. And if you look at it in terms of the striking defense numbers, 49% for Hossa to 69% by Dumont. Dumont doesn't get hit clean very often in these fights. She defends better against long-range attacks in general, or she has in the UFC, at least by the numbers, than Carol Hossa has. But when you look at the level of competition for Dumont up at featherweight, she was rumored to have fights against Holly Holm and some bigger names, but she beat Ashley Evans-Smith at bantamweight. She beats Felicia Spencer. She beats Aspen Ladd in a main event that really happened. Co-main event, Andrei Arlovski versus Carlos Felipe. The UFC's had bad cards before. Lost to Chasson, win over Danielle Wolf. The 5-1 in for Hossa. Beats Vanessa Mello. Beats Jocelyn Edwards. Beats Betch Cohale. Loses to McMahon. Beats Lena Landsberg. And we have a look at the odds in this one, and they have shifted dramatically since, they came out. So Carol Hossa, open minus 225. The odds are at par right now. If you have a look at Norma Dumont, she opened the big underdog, or at least slight underdog, plus 190.
Depends on what site, though, honestly.
Minus 113. So Dumont is, kind of in and around, the odds in and around par for both these women. We have a look at the topology votes. Matt, surprised us there to you. I'm going to say over under 67.5% for Carol Hossa.
Under.
You're going to say under? Yeah, 727 total votes, 78% with Norma Dumont, 91% by decision for the 22% that have Hossa, 89% by decision. Matt, they like that late second round, third round power punching out of the immortal Norma Dumont.
It's a fight that's going to go to split decision, you know? And that's a hard fight to predict because it will be so close by the end of it. Like, two people are going to think it goes one way. One person is going to think it goes the other. Like, I can see this fight being very close by the time it's over because I can see Dumont doing a good job crowding that distance of Hossa and landing some good strikes as she does make her entries. But I do think the volume numbers will be on the side of Hossa, and that's why I think this fight will be so close by the end of it. So, ever so slightly, I'm going to go with Hossa in the matchup because I'll favor her volume. I don't think we're going to get a finish on either side in the matchup, but it's a very close fight, and I could be very much convinced either way.
I mean, it is weird when you have somebody like Hossa last time out, minus 400 favorite in one of those majority decision type of circumstances, albeit because of that illegal knee in the second round. Norma Dumont, very steady, so when you're trying to pick this fight, it really is a little bit of a tricky one. At featherweight, I'm ever so slightly going to go with Carol Hossa in this one. I do like the steadiness on the feet. She definitely throws a lot more for volume. She's not susceptible to getting knocked down in a lot of these fights. And if you consider it for Hossa inside of the UFC's octagon, it's gone pretty darn good. You look at the loss to somebody like Sarah McMahon. It was due to those takedowns and the variety that you saw out of somebody like McMahon. But wins over Fritzen, Mello, Edwards, Correa, and so on. I just like the volume out of somebody like Carol Hossa. She keeps her chin tucked well in some of these exchanges. Dumont on the outside floating, clapping the cheeks. Matt, a lot of people are going to like Norma Dumont in the matchup. She's clapping them. She throws a lot of big punches and claps the cheeks. She knocked down Danielle Wolf a couple of times. What do you think I'm talking about? Keep your mind out of the gutter. Matt, it's a big time fight in a division that, again, like, it is just, there's not fights that happen in this division. Your pick here
is... More people are in this room than are in this division.
It's wild to say. Matt, really eager to hear from the commenters on this one down below. Big time main event, Popovich taking on Blaydes. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
Generational clash coming up at bantamweight this weekend. We have American Top Team and Team Constrictor's own Ronnie Yaya, 2007 ADCC champion. I'm talking about the ledge, and he's going to be welcoming Quick Montel Jackson into the UFC's octagon. And I said this a little bit last weekend. We had Ed Herman, Zach Cummings, and it was a great fight. And both guys got $50,000 as a bonus. But with these aging legends, a lot of MMA fans these days, they don't care about the history. They just don't. It's not like baseball. Baseball right now has a show headlined by Carlos Pena going to Cooperstown and talking about relics of times past.
Can I offer a bit of a rebuttal, though?
Go for it.
MLB doesn't make their aging veterans take an at-bat against the person who just won a Cy Young, and that's unfortunately what the UFC does. The UFC loves nothing more than taking your childhood hero and making them fight the next up-and-coming prospect on their way. Well, that's the biggest difference between the two.
You don't have to shout about it, but for Ronny Yaya, his pro debut was in April of 2002. Matt was 3 years old when that happened.
I'm imagining Derek Jeter trying to take it at bat against modern-day Gerrit Cole.
Ronny Yaya, fifth-degree Brazilian jiu-jitsu black belt. Again, 65-kilogram 2007 ADCC champ. You look at it. 13-4-1 with a no contest in the UFC. He came in fighting Mike Brown and beat him. Mike Brown, now Ronny Yaya's coach. Like, it's just been crazy to see how Yaya's been able to stick around. He's had a lot of injuries and long layoffs. His 5-1 in almost extends back 5 years ago when he beat Luke Sanders. He has a loss to Ricky Simone, who was able to kind of control with the wrestling and the striking. He has a weird majority draw against Enrique Barzola, where first round, Yaya, second round, Yaya, third round.
Not Yaya.
Barzola 10-8'd him easily. And then Yaya's last two performances, he beats Ray Rodriguez, early submission win. And his last time out, beats Kyung Ho Gong, where Ronnie was on Beach Street in the first round. Ronnie, I mean, he was able to rally back really well. And when I look at Ronny Yaya fights, I can go down through the history. I can go down through the guys that he's faced. He had a fight of the night, WEC title fight against Chase Beep. But when you look at a map for Ronny Yaya and you consider all of these, the submission of the night bonuses he had over at WEC, all the wins he has with the UFC, he's at his most strong in that first round.
8 years ago?
When he's walking you down and he's landing those big hooks to get a takedown. He really is reminiscent of a Damian Maia in his fight style. And as the fights go along, usually the power bar depletes, the takedowns get more labored, albeit against Kyung Ho Gong. Early second round takedown, and he controlled on the mat, and he was able to get that backpack and just threaten with the rear naked choke. Third round, he was able to do more of the same, and that was a little bit of a surprise, because we know that Kyung Ho Gong is pretty good on the ground. He's not Ronny Yaya, but he is pretty slippery. Montel Jackson, before he switched over to pro MMA, had his mind set on going to the Olympics for wrestling, and in 2013, when the IOC said, we're done with this wrestling thing, Montel Jackson switched it over into MMA. Matt, 7 fights in the UFC. How many knockdowns does Montel Jackson have?
9.
He's got 7. A lot of knockdowns for Montel Jackson.
It's a tough fight for Ronnie.
A very big power puncher, but sometimes he gets stuck in compromising positions with his grappling.
But he's not a bad grappler, though. And that's the thing. Montel's not a guy who we've seen get convincingly out-grappled for long periods of time. Yes, he's been stuck in positions. And if you get stuck in those positions against a guy like Ronnie, he'll probably finish them. But
now, yeah, you were right. I made a mistake. Last five fights for Montel Jackson, 9 knockdowns. 9 of them.
Look at your boy.
9 of them.
This is my problem with Ronny Yaya. He can win this fight by first round submission, and then I think he's getting the brakes beat off him for a lot of it, because his power bar does deplete as the fight goes on, and not just with his striking, which a lot of people associate with kind of your power bar depleting. His takedowns become a lot less effective, and his grappling becomes a lot less effective too. So if he can slip some of those early boxing combinations of Jackson, get him to the mat, get his back and submit him, maybe it could happen in the opening 90 seconds. But Jackson has legit power that hurts guys as the fight progresses, and he has power from the opening minute to the last minute of a fight. And that's the thing about Jackson, too. Normally, we look at prospects, and if they don't get a lot of finishes earlier on in their career, especially their UFC career, it might not be looked at as a positive thing. I'm really high on Javid Basharat, but, like, he's winning all of his fights by decision. It'd be nice to see him get a finish at a certain point. With Montel, I kind of look at it in a bit of a different light, at least in this matchup. Yes, it would be nice for him to go out there and get more finishes, but Ronnie's the guy that could take advantage of his gas tank, and if Montel can just hurt him early, avoid the big actions of Ronnie, and then finish him late, I could see that being a game plan.
Montel Jackson was Brett John's payday with Bellator, just like, you know, you had Carol Hossa taking on Sarah McMahon. But Jackson, out of the 2 fights that he's lost in the UFC to Ricky Simone and Brett Johns landed 8 takedowns, Ricky Simone landed 7. So the takedown defense for Jackson isn't at the forefront of his game. He's got great offensive takedowns in his own right. It can set up his jiu-jitsu. It's problematic against a guy like Ronny Yaya, but the striking differential for Jackson, 3.39 landed per minute to 1.40 absorbed. It's crazy that way. 6-2 in the UFC. He's been favored in every single fight, and he's been more than a 500 favorite on 4 occasions against JP Bayes, Jesse Strader, Felipe Klarish, and Andre Sukumtoth. He won all of those fights. He's in that pantheon in this fight against Ronny Yaya. Again, the legend. Ronny Yaya, fought Kid Yamamoto, Mark Hominick, Eddie Wineland, and Joseph Benavidez before Yaya was in the UFC.
Been there, done that.
Ronnie Yaya, in the year of our Lord, 2023, as the saying goes, is getting called out by Cody Garbrandt. Weak sauce, my guy, on MMA Junkie. But Matt, when you look at this one, Jackson's a big favorite. Yaya is a pretty big underdog. You have a look at the Tapology votes. I'm going to say over under 95% Montel Jackson.
Under, but very high.
It breaks my heart. 88% of the fans going Jackson, 48% by knockout. For the 12% that have Yaya, 54% by submission, 32% by decision, out of 28 pro victories. Like, he has over 20 submission wins. Ronnie Yaya, he's going to take your arm home. He's going to take the back. He's going to get it done. But when I look at a matchup like this, I think Jackson has all of the strengths. I think Jackson gets the win with a strike. And I think he drops Yaya and breaks my damn heart. I'm one of those old heads with the Leonardo Santos.
Is he
going to
Tayo Cruz you? He's only going to break your heart?
Yeah. And then just go out with a whimper and never make more big songs, become a big producer.
I throw my head. Tayo Cruz has some bangers now that I'm thinking
for
of.
For a short stretch.
I have Montel Jackson, though, in this matchup, without a doubt.
All right, Matt, both of us going with Montel Jackson in this one. If you have a look at it, it's got to be awkward for both guys. They're probably walking through the halls with sunglasses, seeing Ricky Simone out there picking up wins over them. So a big-time matchup, Matt. Simone's taking on Sung Yadong in the co-main event. Main event, Pavlovich Blades. You're not going to want to miss. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Lightweights in search of their first win since 2021. A couple of opposing nicknames. We have the Gladiator, Ricky Glenn, taking on the Spartan, Christos Yagos. And when you look at this, I mean, a couple of losses on the way for Christos Yagos. Armin Tsarukyan and Thiago Moises, those last two fights. And if you look at it for Yagos, both of those training camps taking place in South Florida at Sanford, a.k.a. Killcliff FC. And he moved over there after beating their guy, Sean Soriano. That's Yagos' last win. A couple of guys in their second stints with the UFC. And it was Yagos losing the first round and coming back strong in the second round. And Yagos is one of those guys that the cardio is kind of up and then it's down, and he fights at a really high pace. And I'm going to talk about an interview that he did with one GM or JHK with the All-Star MMA as we move along. But for Ricky Glenn, radio silence since the last time that he fought against Grant Dawson. Lost the first round, lost the second round, got held down in the third round.
Came back.
He nearly finished Grant Dawson. It was a 10-8 by all accounts in that third round. So that is why it's a draw on his record. Ricky Glenn, World Series of Fighting featherweight champ. He was a big underdog in his breakout performance against Gavin Tucker in the UFC. And that's kind of the craziest part about this fight. This is how I'm going to hand it off to you. Best version of both of these guys. I'd say for Ricky Glenn, it was that Gavin Tucker performance. It's in Canada. The scorecards, 30-25, 30-24, 29-27. He was a plus 275 underdog against Tucker. And Joe Rogan was singing Tucker's praises as Ricky Glenn was beating him down. But the worst version of Ricky Glenn, I have two versions. One against Miles Jury and one against Angel of Death, Kevin Aguilar. Where Aguilar, right hand drops Ricky Glenn in the third round. All six scorecards, 30-27. So best version of Glenn beating Gavin Tucker with the boxing and the overall skill set. Even Ricky Glenn's takedowns. But against Aguilar, he just couldn't really figure out the distance and he couldn't really get his boxing going. For Yagos, best version, I would say, against maybe Demir Hadzovic or Carlton Minus, making it gritty, working in his takedowns, threatening kind of all over the place. But the worst version, I mean, you go ahead and pick one. Like, it's a rookie. Against some of the better fighters, that's where Christos Yagos has fallen off.
I get told this by a basketball coach, and I think about this in MMA all the time, even when I break down fights. I get told by a basketball coach, if I give you 20 shots, how do you take all those 20 shots? And you have to think, right? Like, that's a lot of shots to take. Like, what spots would I be in? I think about fights all the time where it's like, okay, if you give the fighter the exact positions they want to be in for all 15 minutes, how would the fight look? I've talked about this with Joanne, formerly Calderwood, now Wood. It's like, hey, if the fight goes exactly to game plan, it's probably going to end in, what, a split decision, right? Because a lot of the fights are close. For Christos Yagos, I think about his pacing in this way. If you give him 15 minutes to hit the bag, your first 9 minutes are going to be absurd. They're going to look so nice. But the problem is, he's not going to be able to pace himself and envision those last 6 minutes to really matter, even when he's hitting the bag by himself outside of an MMA match. If you give Ricky Glenn 15 minutes to hit a bag, steady. Just, it will never change. His pacing will not change. And that's why I think pacing in this fight is really going to be the key for both guys. Because I think Yagos does burn a little bit hotter early on in the fight. And that might mistake you into thinking, oh, Yagos is kind of the more high volume guy out of the two. And it's not that he doesn't have good volume at all. That's not the point I'm trying to get across. But he does have high volume early, and it diminishes as the fight goes on. So I think for Yagos, it's weird to say this, but I do think it will be a key to try to bank those first two rounds. And I know we'll probably talk more about the grappling in a little bit. Yagos does have more grappling, I would say, in his back pocket, at least at the offensive variety. He has submissions and a lot more sweeps off his back, but Ricky Glenn has that consistency with his striking that can give Yagos a lot of issues.
Glenn's one of those guys that for the longest time trained at a Team Alpha Male, then he made the move back home to Iowa. I mean, Robbie Lawler's home. A Kill Cliff guy with Christos Yagos, but he's now out of Absolute Martial Arts and Fitness, and when you look at it for a guy like Ricky Glenn, he was off from 2018 to 2021 due to major hip surgery. So he comes back, takes on Joaquim Silva. That right cross was the money, and he was able to drop Silva twice and get that finish win. And then again, against Grant Dawson, struggled with the takedown defense round one, round two. Round three, he was a fresher fighter, and he got the win. And Yagos was originally supposed to take on Benoit Saint-Denis back last year. He was forced out of that fight, and out of the interview that he did with JHK, he was pulled from that fight because he was remodeling his house, and the family was supposed to come over. And I'm paraphrasing as I tell the story. Go watch the interview. But he was cleaning the house after he, remodeled, and they had taken a toilet out. What happens when you take a toilet out? Sometimes you drop it, you get a little bit of porcelain. He had some in a garbage bag, and he went to pour that out, and just a sliver of that porcelain came out and severed two tendons on his pinky finger. So he had to kind of go through the rehab. Back in December, he was hitting the bag at 100%, getting ready for this fight. You look at it, and if you do consider it, like, it's interesting. He's trained with a lot of southpaws at the gym. Killcliff FC, so many great training partners over there. The Michael Chandlers of the world and so on and so forth in these lower weight classes. But if you consider it, I mean, against a guy like Armin Tsarukyan, first round, defends the takedown, digs up, and gets the takedown out of his own right before he ends up getting finished. Against Thiago Moises, Moises just kind of jumps out, grabs the back up against the cage, and gets the submission win, gets that tap. But for Yagos, like, even the minus fight, burns really hot, gets some really good takedowns.
Do you think the last fight for Ricky Glenn against Dawson is a good precursor for this matchup? Because, again, you're fighting a guy who's dangerous on the feet because a lot of his work done on the mat. And you realize, okay, even if I lose the battle early, I can still win the war as the fight progresses. I think that kind of a matchup will be a confidence builder for Glenn.
It's got to be, there's a little bit of confidence, I think, for a guy like Yagos, because he was able to step in on 3 days' notice and replace Ricky Glenn against Carlton Minus to get that last win. So you got that one over him a little bit. I think the southpaw stance from a guy like Ricky Glenn, although you train with southpaws, Ricky Glenn trains with orthodox fighters all the time. They do always have that slight advantage due to southpaws. When I look at a matchup like this, Christos Yagos has decent boxing, and it's always been the part of his game to me that's kind of had to come along as things have progressed. I know he had a really kind of knock him out, drag him out type of fight against Oliveira in the first round when they fought, you know, Charles. And then in the second round, Oliveira is able to go out there and get the finish. It's just, Yagos, put the skills on a board. Is he a better wrestler and grappler? Yeah, I'd say so. Is he a better striker? No, because he leads with his chin out all the time in his fights.
The TJ Brown. Here,
and he leads with his chin out. So Yagos could struggle in some of those in-betweens. That was kind of my big point in this fight. So if I do look at this one, Matt, I struggle with the pick a little bit. Ricky Glenn's a pretty big favorite. That's what kind of scares me out of it. And the odds have shifted. Glenn open minus 225. He's a minus 200 favorite right now. We have a look at the Tapology vote. Surprise to us, they are to you. Long layoffs when you're 34 aren't good.
True.
So, and for Ricky Glenn, his last time out against Grant Dawson was a year and a half ago. I'm going to say over under 70% Ricky Glenn.
I think it'll be under.
It's going to be under. It's over 704 total votes. 87% Glenn, 76% by decision for the 13% that have Yagos, 70% by decision as well. So a couple of finishers at lightweight. People think it's going to a decision. What do you make of this one?
I have Ricky Glenn ever so slightly, though. I don't love the odds on this matchup whatsoever because I think it'll be a close fight. And I really do think the cardio of Glenn is going to be important because Yagos could easily win those first two rounds. And if you're admitting that, then you openly admit he could win the matchup easily by decision or either their finish too. But I do think the consistency of Glenn is going to shine through in that third round. I know he didn't get the win over Dawson, but that was really impressive to see him be able to shine through and carry his power and output into the third round. I share his sentiment and worry about his injuries and the layoff, and that's why I say ever so slightly, but the pick is going to be Ricky Glenn.
I'm really eager to see these two guys weigh in, especially, and if it does go late, I mean, I do ever so slightly favor Ricky Glenn. Like, he's pretty tight with his boxing combinations. I mentioned it earlier on, in tight space, Kevin Aguilar was able to land kind of like a, not to discredit him, but it seemed like kind of a pedestrian right hand, and it dropped Ricky Glenn, and then Aguilar was able to capitalize off of that. I'm going to go with Ricky Glenn ever so slightly, but the underdog pick in Christos Yagos with those takedowns and that work rate in the motor, you might really like Christos Yagos. And in the headline of JHK's interview with the All-Stars, Christos Yagos versus Ricky Glenn matchup, severed pinky tendons and Islam Makhachev title defense. And he really likes the fact that Ricky Glenn's one of those guys at lightweight that you have to watch out for. Both of us in the matchup going with the Gladiator, Ricky Glenn. Let us know down below in the comment section who you have. Some big fights left on this card that you're not going to want to miss. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say,
let's get into it.
Tentatively scheduled to kick off the main card coming up this weekend, a couple of Atlantic-based welterweight finishers. We have the former CES and CFFC champ, Jeremiah Wells. He's going to be meeting up with Semi the Jedi, Matt Semelsberger. And when you look at a matchup like this, Matt, I can't still, at this point, I've watched the fight three or four times now, understand that, like, it just doesn't register. Matt Semelsberger dropped Jake Matthews not once, not twice, but three times, once in each round in his last fight.
Great.
He hit as a plus 225 underdog. He looked really good in that matchup. And for Semelsberger, you look at it so far in the UFC, obviously more wins than he has losses. But the losses are to Chaos Williams in a really close contest. And then a loss to Alex Morono where Semelsberger couldn't figure out the distance in the first round and the second round. And if you've ever seen Alex Morono fight, he's herky-jerky.
He's
on the outside. And in the first round and the second round of that matchup, he just circled away from the power. And Semelsberger couldn't land that really long jab that he has and that right cross. And so Morono was able to do great work. Kind of, I don't know if it was a clash of heads or a really hard right hand, but it swelled up the eye of Semelsberger. End of the second round, he thought it might get finished. So what did Semelsberger do in the third round? He's going to go out on his shield. He starts really power punching close to the distance with a flying knee. Absolutely drops Alex Morono. And I'll throw a picture from that fight. Daniel Cormier was out of his seat, like freaking out. And he was like, oh no, Morono's going to lose this fight.
It
was an amazing comeback for Semelsberger, even though he lost the fight. So Semelsberger, he's been in there. He's had some really gritty, tough performances. And I listened to an interview that he did with James Lynch, and I want to make sure that I get this one right, because he said, and I quote, "The weight cut, the fight's next Saturday, how's that all going?" That's what James Lynch said. Semelsberger says, "Good man, I'm big right now though, I'm not gonna lie, but in a good way." And he talks about it in the fact that in some of his fights, he likes to carry himself heavy, to come in and kind of, not, now this is really stretching it, and I'm saying this, to kind of weight bully a little bit with that, but he likes to have some of that size advantage to bring into the fight. And in some fights, he likes to be a little bit lighter, fleet of foot on the outside. So he's coming in a little bit bigger for this one. And he also said, kind of thinking that he's made peace a little bit with the fact that he could get slept against a guy like Jeremiah Wells, because for Wells in the UFC, he's finished everybody. And he's only the second man to finish Court McGee. He did that his last time out quickly.
I worry about Semelsberger for this reason in this fight. There's two versions of him. Like, when we do get that outside version who doesn't throw a lot of volume, he's kind of eliminating one of the bigger positives in his own game, and that's what I don't like to see, because we've seen that from Semelsberger in fights. We've seen both versions of him in fights, where he will be on the outside, he will be a little bit hesitant. The reason the Chaos Williams fight was so close was because neither guy really did much of anything, really. It's not because, oh, it was a great fight where it could have gone either way. It was just sort of a low-volume affair, and that has to do with Semelsberger and Williams, to be fair. But for Semelsberger, we will see those periods of inactivity. And if he does get caught just looking in a mirror against Wells, Wells can come with that big storm early in a fight.
Wells can, and we've seen that out of him in the UFC. He beat Warley Alves in a fight where It was almost like, shut the lights off, my eyes are closed, and he just started throwing, and Alves kind of landed a bit of a counter in the first round, but in the second round, that's where Wells is able to get the knockout. Against Blood Diamond, he walks into the cage and stumbles.
It's like his controller got disconnected. It was weird.
And then he ended up getting the takedown and completely controlled Blood Diamond.
Parkour.
Mike Mathitha is what he turned him into on the ground. And he finished Court McGee with a left hook. But if you look at Wells kind of coming into the UFC, some of the wins, he had beaten UFC vet John Manley. And he had a loss to Manny Wallow and Vinicius De Jesus. The De Jesus fight was to retain that CES welterweight title. And if you watch Jeremiah Wells in just the De Jesus fight, first round was kind of all over the place. But second round, third round, fourth round, fifth round, like it was a pretty close fight. There was what? I think it was a 49-46 and 48-47. So it was a close enough fight. But Wells is on the outside, circling around. Wasn't like right in the face like he has been in the UFC. And if we get Wells like that against Semelsberger, it could be a little bit of a weird one. Semelsberger, he's a guy out of the DMV. And he's going to go out there and train out of some of those gyms in the Maryland and D.C. area. Out of Crazy 88 Martial Arts Coach. And I mispronounce his name every single time. But I'm going to get it right this time. John Delbruge. Delbruge is his head coach. He's going to be in his corner for this fight. As well as Sebastian Ramirez and Josh Jackson. A guy who they just keep bringing back in the NFL as quarterback. But no, Josh Jackson, pro MMA fighter. And Matt, in that interview with Lynch, kind of alluded to the fact that you should see Jackson in a bigger organization coming soon. But usually his older brother's in his corner. He's not going to be in his corner for this fight. So that's a little interesting there. But Semelsberger, when it comes to the groundwork out of these guys, Semelsberger, starting his pro MMA career, my only knock was he could get held down and kind of just, he ends up kind of holding guard.
He's good offensive wrestling, though.
And waiting. But his offensive wrestling has come a long way. He is a BJJ blue belt. Jeremiah Wells is a BJJ black belt out of Marquez MMA and Hensel Gracie Philly. He trains with those guys in Sean Brady, Joe Pfeiffer, Jonathan Potsy, and the like. Jeremiah Wells, in my opinion, is a better ground fighter than Matt Semelsberger. We'll see if he goes to any of that because we haven't seen it in the UFC, but it definitely is there in the back pocket. I guess we did see it against Blood Diamond.
We did, yeah.
But when you look at a guy like Wells, is the wildness, is the chaos, will we see that in this matchup? He is such a heavy puncher. He is at such a disadvantage in terms of the height. But
and
his
he's
reach is kind of close.
Old too.
Yeah, he is 36, but when you look at it, he's a young 36 for MMA. So we'll see how that translates in a matchup like this. Obviously, Semelsberger in these wins. I mean, the power jab, right cross. Against Martin Sanoh, really quick finish. Against AJ Fletcher, struggled in the first round mightily against the takedown. Rallied round two, close round three. A lot of people were upset and they thought the ghost AJ Fletcher had won that fight. And then again, Morono and the other loss being to Chaos Williams. But Matt Semelsberger has been a very interesting case and he alluded to it in that interview with James Lynch. And he said, listen, I had one fight left on my contract after Jake Matthews. They re-upped me. It's a new four-fight deal for him. So that's his third contract in the UFC. He has a performance bonus with that win over Jason Witt. That was his second fight in the UFC. And he just kind of ground out Carlton Minus to kick off his career. So Matt, in this matchup, we have a look at the odds. And if you do consider it for a guy like Jeremiah Wells, wave of success. He is the favorite in the matchup. The odds are closing into par in this one. We have a look at the Topology vote. Surprise to us as they are
great
to you.
Fight.
I'm going to say over under 62.5% Wells. I think they're going to be close. You think they're going to be under? They're over. So 687 total votes, 67% Wells, 65% by knockout. For the 33% that have Semelsberger, 47% by decision, 45% by knockout. You're surprised by the Topology picks.
Because I am the underdog, and that's why. I think Minus and Matthews are both more well-rounded fighters than Wells is. And not saying that that means that Semelsberger is going to win this fight, but he has experience against some high-level fighters. And I know he doesn't always show up to the peak of his capacity. I myself have really been critical about him with his lack of output in some of these fights, but when we get the highest level of Matt Semelsberger, he is a pretty good fighter. So I think it is a very close fight. I could see him getting finished. I could honestly see this fight ending by finish either way, which makes it so close. But I'll go with a slight underdog in Semelsberger in the matchup.
Jeremiah Wells was a champ on the regional scene with CFFC, while Matt Semelsberger was 3-2 with CFFC, if you do consider it. I mean, Jeremiah Wells in 2019 was getting a win over Marco Smallman, who was 6-2 at the time. So a big win there for Wells. He's better at the jiu-jitsu.
Oh, yeah.
He's a tricky striker to gauge when he's on the outside. I like Matt Semelsberger's distance-finding abilities, and I really do like the fact that he's a steadier fighter from what I've seen in his fights that he's had in the UFC. He's been the more active guy. He's been the guy rounding out his skill set. I think if he takes it to the ground, that's probably a mistake. But if Semelsberger is saying he's going to be a bigger guy coming in, this is a fight that I got to see him weigh in on Friday.
Good point.
He's never missed weight, and he alluded to that with James Lynch. But for me, I will go with Matt Semelsberger in the matchup. But I'm really eager to hear from the folks in this one. I mean, Wells is a slight favorite. It's going to power. The fans overwhelmingly have Wells.
And the winner should get a big fight. I think that's fair to say. Like, for Wells and Semelsberger, Semelsberger's been around for a while now, so I think he is deserving of a bigger name opponent. And for Wells, he's been on a great run. If you beat a guy like Semelsberger, that's the name on your resume that then makes you deserving of a bigger opponent.
You got to give credit where it's due. That interview that Semelsberger did with James Lynch was with All Access MMA. Matt, both of us going with Semi the Jedi. Semelsberger in the matchup to bring the win back to Maryland, the former Marist College strong safety. You got to mention that one up there, 215 pounds. A big time matchup in this division. This is tentatively scheduled to kick off the main card. The next one, Lucindo taking on Walker. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
Thanks so much for joining us with Fight Night Picks. You made it all the way through. We're into the main card, and I just want to, again, really, really thank the Fight Night Picks faithful for tuning in for fights like this. And I'll switch it on over to the prediction video view, because when you look at it, Matt, I'll play that old sullen desert wind. And the reason being, I have no idea why this is on the main card of anything. Coming up this weekend, this one, they say, is at flyweight. We have Yasmin Lucindo taking on Brogan the Bear Walker. Because I was going to say Walker Sanchez. And it was Brogy the Bear before, but now it's the Bear. Matt, this is a very head-scratching fight. Because for Brogan Walker, she was featured on the last season of The Ultimate Fighter. She was a second pick on her team behind Claire Guthrie. That was Team Nunes. She gets a win over Hannah Guy. Dropped her in the first round. Grappled in that fight. She beats Gallardo, who wasn't even supposed to be on the season. It was a really close fight. And then she goes out and takes on Juliana Miller. And I said earlier on this card, when we were kicking it off, like, wins and losses are what they are. And all of a sudden, with rose-colored glasses, you have a win for Priscilla Cachueto over Arianny Lipsky that ages so well. Brogan Walker's loss to Juliana Miller now ages so bad because of how Miller looked in her UFC debut against Veronica Hardy not that long ago. But for Brogan Walker, being kind of a southpaw Muay Thai type of striker, Lucindo, also a Muay Thai striker, but for Brogan Walker, she's in, she's out, lead hands pretty far out.
Good boxing.
She throws a really good left hook. She does a bit of a lean back. That's what got her caught against Miller. The takedown defense got her caught against Miller, even though Walker would go in for takedowns in that fight against Miller.
And that was the most confusing thing about Walker. She is a very talented striker.
She's a jiu-jitsu black belt, too, but she was more kind of looking for the takedown, which forced the action.
And she got out-scrambled.
She got out-scrambled. She lost due to TKO, third-round ground and pound by Miller. So she loses, but she still ends up in the UFC. Just like Zach Paunga loses by knockout, but still ends up in the UFC, and he won his UFC debut. So Brogan Walker could win this fight. Now, Matt, for Yasmin Lucindo, she beat Sarah Frota on the regional scene, who was in the UFC and then out. She beat
Had a hard time making weight in the UFC.
Yeah, she beat Luzcrezia Ria over with Cage Fight, and that was about a year ago. That's somebody who had a win on Contender Series, so some wins that made some sense. And then she comes into the UFC and takes on Yasmin Jauregui, so that was very confusing, on that UFC San Diego
card.
Great
fight, though.
Great fight. I mean, really, awesome. Like, that was a fight of the night type fight. Now, the one thing that's kind of concerning for Lucindo, at strawweight, and she had strawweight, bantamweight, and flyweight experience coming into the UFC, Lucindo weighs in successfully at 116. But that fight was in California, brother. So we get those weigh-in numbers. Matt, she rehydrated too. 131.4. So she gained 15.4 pounds between Friday to Saturday. She looked really good. The only concerning thing that I have about Lucindo, because I think she continues to gain things to her tool belt, is the fact that 41% strike output or strike percentage in the first round, then 38, then 29. It was a little bit more labored. She kind of got beat to the punch. The numbers went down as the fight went on. But for Lucindo, I had said before she made her UFC debut, she throws a lot of arm punches and a really good right kick to the body. but she's kind of tightened things up as things have gone on, and I really have liked that out of Lucindo. I don't know how that's going to carry against somebody like Walker.
I still think the output's going to be a big X factor in the fight, though, because for Walker, the story is kind of out on her. Even when she does have success with her striking, the takedowns are still going to be an issue for her moving forward. And again, Lucindo's going to have a lot of her own success.
Whoa. They weren't a problem when she fought Miranda Maverick. Her takedown defense carried her to a win.
No, but again, for Walker, I think it is going to be difficult for her to find those ranges to where, okay, I can now have success with my striking, and now I'm defending with my takedowns, because she is a talented boxer, but I do think she's going to struggle with fighters who do have that kind of plus output and plus wrestling, because on the in-betweens, we have seen her struggle not only in the past against people like Miller, but her jiu-jitsu's good, her striking's good. I think the wrestling against some of these fighters is going to be difficult for her. Now, if she's able to really damage them on those in-betweens, then yes, she will be able to kind of make up the difference of the control on the other end. And I think that's why this fight is really interesting, because if Lucindo comes into this fight like she did against Halhagi and has a similar matchup to where it's that high output, they're both kind of in each other's faces, I think it will be difficult for Walker to find those ranges to where she can tee off and land those bigger shots. Because if Walker does have the range to really kind of frame off and set up her bigger shots, I could see her having success on the outside.
Well, and Walker was supposed to be taking on Liang Na back last month. That would have been her debut. Liang Na is out of the matchup, and Yasmin Lucindo was supposed to be taking on Melissa Martinez. So I would think those fights would be at strawweight. Topology says it's at strawweight. UFC Stats says it's at flyweight. UFC.com says it's at flyweight. And the UFC press release that I got to the email says flyweight. So it might switch to strawweight, and that might skew this pick. But for right now, we're going to assume this one is at flyweight. And as I said with Lucindo, she had a catchweight fight that was almost at featherweight at one point, and also has flyweight experience. So when you do look at this matchup, Matt, for Walker, she beat Miranda Maverick, defended the takedowns in the first round. It was a really close first round. Second round, I had it for Walker with a striking. Third round, I had it really close. Walker ends up getting the win, 30-27, 30-27, 29-28. And when she fought Emily King, her win before she ended up on The Ultimate Fighter, she picked up a performance bonus with Invicta in that one. She can get it done with the hands. She has good jiu-jitsu, bringing it all together out of Supa MMA Gym over in Guam. Originally from California, moved over to Guam, trains out of Guam. When you look at a matchup like this, Matt, Lucindo trains out of Fight House. I mean, you consider it for her, she got into MMA because of a bad situation at home. She started off in MMA at 14. She trains with Vina Janjidoba and Tina Block. The weirdest nickname. I still don't understand it. Valeska Machado. But if you do look at it for her, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu purple belt she was awarded back in December. So it's the purple belt of Lucindo, the black belt of Brogan Walker, Brogy the Bear. You consider it, Lucindo is a pretty big favorite in the matchup. We have a look at the Tapology votes. A lot of shine off that loss for Lucindo. Not a lot of shine off the loss for Brogan Walker. I'm going to say over under 85% Lucindo.
I think it'll be under, but she'll be a favorite.
And it's on. 681 total votes, 86% Lucindo, 82% by decision for the 14% that have Walker, 74% by decision. Matt, I think if Walker is going to go out there and mix her martial arts, she can get a win in this matchup. The southpaw look is a little bit different. If Lucindo goes out there and just throws caution to the wind and fights like a banshee, like we've seen her do in the past, Lucindo could definitely get a win in this matchup. I do have Lucindo, the varied, more steady output out of her. But again, Walker, Sofa, tricky something.
I think we both said this about Lucindo after her last fight. It was, hey, she lost, but still has a pretty good ceiling, I would say. Like, she's only 21 years old. It's going to continue to get
better.
It's like
Zell Huber lost to Ogden, and then Zell Huber looked good against Manara.
Exactly. Looked like a new man. So I think for Lucindo, she can make those improvements as her career progresses. And I do like this matchup against Walker, who, again, isn't the most well-known commodity, but has had some good fights on her resume.
And Lucindo, being the Muay Thai striker, on her fights on the regional scene, she's billed as a Muay Thai striker, but it was all takedowns. So we'll see if she goes back to that in this matchup with Walker, with that Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu purple belt she was just awarded, like Lucia Pudzalova tried to do last weekend against Jocelyn Edwards, but the win was taken away. So Matt, when you have a look at this matchup, both of us going with Yasmin Lucindo. We look at it next, Matt, possible fight of the night. Bobby Green is going to be taking on Jared Gordon. Flash Gordon, you're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
From the UFC's apex this weekend at lightweight. It's a get back, get right type of fight. We have King Bobby Green looking to make it a big time comeback, and he's lost two straight. He's going to be taking on a man who has worn Julian Arosa's shoes. I'm talking about Jared Flash Gordon, a couple of guys that got absolutely just... I don't even know what word to use. They got absolutely screwed, I guess, by the judges. And for Jared Gordon's last time out against Paddy Pimblett, I went to MMA Decisions. Dan Urban of Couchside Judges scored the fight 29-28 for Pimblett, while 12 other media members scored it 29-28 Gordon, 11 scored it 30-27 Gordon. On the rewatch, I scored it 30-27 Gordon, which is what I scored it originally. I have no idea how Jared Gordon didn't win that fight by those judges' accounts. But when you have a look at it, Douglas Crosby and Ron McCarthy scored round one and round two for Paddy Pimblett, who was outstruck and outgrappled in that one. But regardless of what happened, Matt, Jared Gordon isn't going out there and fighting a much lesser opponent. He's fighting somebody that's of that caliber, just outside of the top 15.
What I really like about this fight is both guys are getting a very different opponent from what they normally face, because Gordon and Bobby Green are sort of those outside the top 15 gatekeepers, right? You're a prospect on your way up. Jared Gordon's a very well-rounded mixed martial artist who has great cardio. That's a great opponent for any of these high-level prospects to
He's
face.
He's got a good chin, too.
And on the flip side, Bobby Green has great boxing combinations. We all know how talented he is as a striker, but also has some obvious flaws in his games, too, that were, hey, if you are sort of that top-tier prospect, you are going to be able to pass it. That's why I like this fight for both guys. They're sort of getting out of that mold, and they're both getting into sort of the general lightweight division and facing off against each other, because I have a hard time with this matchup, especially with where the odds are, because Bobby Green is a bigger favorite. We'll talk about that more later, but it is interesting because both guys are normally fighting prospects, and we don't really know how they match up against other well-rounded mixed martial artists in the lightweight division, but it's interesting to see how Gordon has progressed throughout his career, and it's why I'm surprised to see he hasn't been given the respect from the odds makers, because Gordon earlier on was much more of a wrestler than he was a boxer. It was get his guy to the ground, ground and pound, try to rough them up, get them tired, and look for the finish later on in fights. But what's the biggest part of his game that has grown lately? His boxing. It's become a lot more crisp, a lot more compact, and that's why I'm surprised he hasn't been given more respect, because I do think he can hold his own in some, not all, of course. I think he can hold his own in some boxing exchanges with a guy like Bobby Green, but I think this is going to be a really fun fight, because neither guy is going to become a much lesser version of themselves in the third round than they are in the first round. We should get three very close, very competitive rounds.
No, I mean, a couple of guys that the cardio never wanes. Bobby Green can really rely on the fact that he did lose to Fazeev, but in the third round, he was beating 100%. Him, and he looked really good with his combinations. The awkward part about the rewatch of Green versus Dober, does Bobby Green win that first round? 110%. Every single person that they brought onto the commentary, whether it was the three on the panel or the coach that they brought in, it was, hey, Bobby Green, this unorthodox defense, this is great. I mean, he's keeping his hands down, he's doing the shoulder roll. And then a big right hand lands for Drew Dober, and then he falls like a sack of potatoes. And Bobby Green protested the stoppage at the time. I thought Keith Peterson did a great job. Some people didn't like Keith Peterson's stoppage of Bozer and Kutsalaba last weekend, but against Bobby Green, it was a pretty darn good stoppage, because it was the second right hand that really did drop him after he already got wobbled. But when you look at a guy like Green, the last two fights, I'm going to say somewhat forgivable. The fight against Islam Makhachev, what's going to happen? You take a main event on short notice, that happens. The fight against Drew Dober, I called it. It was the right that landed first, then it was the left hook that dropped him and gets the finish. Before that, wins over Nazareth Hakpras, Ali Aquinta, and then the Fazeev fight. That's a 5-1 in for Bobby Green. For Jared Gordon, who's 7-5 in the UFC, he had a fight of the night against Joaquim Silva, if you can remember that one. A two-rounder where he gets finished. But Danny Chavez, a win. Joe Selecki, split decision win. He loses to Grant Dawson, beats Leonardo Santos, and did he ever, my guy. And then he loses to Paddy Pimblett, but that was very controversial. You look at it, Matt, like, again, Bobby Green's carrying that torch of guys that have fought with Strikeforce and Affliction. Bobby Green, that Affliction card that Green fought on, where he lost by submission to Dan Lozon, was co-main evented by the guy that lost to Jake Gyllenhaal a few weeks ago.
Jay Huron.
So Bobby Green, he was on that Affliction card.
I'm definitely watching the new Roadhouse. Like, when I thought Ronda Rousey was the main character, no way. I love me some Jake Gyllenhaal. Nightcrawler?
Hot Ones?
The Zodiac? Like, he's been in some great movies.
Yeah. prisoners, Jake Gyllenhaal. But Matt, when you prisoners do look at a matchup like this,
but it was good.
Bobby Green, I mean, with the shoulder roll, the speed hasn't eluded him even at 36. At 34, true, Jared Gordon's only rounded out into a better martial artist, the guy that spent a lot of time in Philly, in Rufus Sport, and then, of course, at Killcliffe FC. Lots of great training partners. We've already touched on that with the Killcliffe FC fighters that are on this card, including in this division. I'm talking about one, Christos Yagos, the Spartan. But when you look at a matchup like this, Matt, Bobby Green's fared well against wrestlers in the past. They've always put him up against wrestlers, and he's had good takedown defense. He almost does like a power plant stance, like a guitar player putting his legs way out there.
His feet are down even when he defends punches, so it is a natural position for him to defend takedowns. And, like, unless you're Habib or Islam, it's difficult to take
them down. I put it as Icon MMA, but if it's Pinnacle, if it's any of those gyms in South Florida, Northern California.
There we go.
If you look at it for Bobby Green, training with guys like Jamal Emmers, like at the time, I mean, former bantamweight stud, Darian Caldwell over with Bellator, how the mighty have fallen. But when you look at a guy like Bobby Green, he's rounded himself into such a good fighter. Again, he is a pretty big favorite in the matchup. He is 14-11-1 under the Strikeforce Affliction UFC banner. We have a look at the topology votes, Matt. Surprise us there to you. I'm going to say over under 70% Bobby Green.
I think they'll be over.
I think they're going to be over. They're way over. 831 total votes, 82% Green, 76% by decision. For the 18% that have Gordon, 74% by decision. Matt, the fans have Green. Green is a big favorite in this fight.
It's closer than the odds would have.
Do you have Bobby Green in the matchup?
I do, but ever so slightly. If I were to set the odds, and I know it doesn't matter, but I'd have Bobby Green at like a -175, 155, like in between that range, exactly. Because I do favor his volume, and I do like the fact that I've never really seen him get convincingly out-grappled by a guy like Jared Gordon. I've seen him get out-grappled, but it's by higher levels of opposition than Gordon. And I like that Gordon has been able to improve his boxing, but I still don't know if it's at the level of a guy like Bobby Green. So I'll favor Bobby Green with the volume. And let me say this too, because it has to be mentioned. Bobby Green's mentioned like, oh, retirement and stuff like that. Bobby Green says that before and after every single fight he's had for the last 5 years. So I don't put a ton of stock into that. I do have Green ever so slightly, but I think this is a really fun fight.
Yeah, when you do have a look at it for Bobby Green, you talk about the wrestlers. Thiago Moises is one of those guys that had some success in their fight. Clay Guida had a little bit of success. Lando Venata was able to mix it up a bit, but by and large, Bobby Green's winning fights against wrestlers, other than the fight of the night against Lando Venata in the first stanza. Four fight of the nights, two performance bonuses for Green. I like Green. I mean, every single time that Dober was coming in, he was catching him with the right hook, and he was able to bounce out of the way. So I do like Green with a variety of shots, but we did see that chin compromise the last time out. Yeah. Maybe that's going to be a story as the career goes on and as it gets a little bit later into the twilight of that career for a guy like King Bobby Green. But in this one, both of us going with Green. Jared Gordon, though, I mean, my gosh, you talk about a guy that's well-rounded and can mix all of his martial arts. And again, the shoe is on that foot. Go back and watch that Julian Arosa, Paddy Pimblett fight if you know what I'm talking about. It's a big-time fight, Matt, and it really puts us over into the three remain on this card. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say,
let's get into it.
In 2023, the tickets to the Bruno Silva show, Matt, they're free. You want them?
I mean, I'm good.
Nobody wants them anymore. Bruno Silva coming up this weekend, the former M1 Global Middleweight Champ. He's going to be taking on the Ultimate Fighter Season 11 alum, Brad Tavares. And when you have a look at this fight, Matt, for Bruno Silva, I say that with the tickets with the expired scratchers from Christmas like 3 years ago. I don't know why they're still in the spare room, but they were. When you look at a guy like Bruno Silva, he was riding a wave of momentum. He beat Alexander Shlemenko. He beat Artem Frolov. And then he comes over to the UFC, doesn't pass the USADA test, bold and own in its metabolites, so a couple of years of sussies. But when you have a look at it, he beats former training partner Wellington Turman in the first round. He beats Andrew Sanchez in a crazy third round comeback, gets a performance bonus. He beats Jordan Wright in the first round, performance bonus. He loses to Alex Pereira, but he gives him everything he's got. And his last time out against Jiro Mearshart, he showed up with his head shaved and a goatee, and he looked like a shell of himself. And in the second round, he was huffing and a puffing. It was a Bruno we haven't really seen before, and I don't know if that's the norm now. I don't know if Alex Pereira beat the soul out of Bruno Silva, but Jiro Mearshart certainly did.
He did, yeah.
He throws a hook, He drops Silva, and then he just kind of gets on top, gets a guillotine, and that's all she wrote.
Would you agree with me that all three fights at the top of this card are kind of fights between polar opposites? Because in this fight, we have Brad Tavares, who is kind of a picture of consistency, right? He's going to fight kind of at the same pace, not really get outside of himself, fight by the basics, not do anything that really wows you. Whereas
Bruno leg Silva kicks. His leg kicks are very, very good.
But Bruno Silva's going to burn very hot. There's big looping power shots. Can carry his power late, although I wouldn't say he has incredible cardio.
I don't know.
No, that's what I mean. He carries his power late, but his output doesn't continue to be very high.
No, that's wrong.
He'll still throw the heavy shots and they can still land, but I don't think he's going to win a third round against a guy like Brad Tavares. I think Tavares' straight shots down the middle are really going to disrupt some of the rhythm of a guy like Bruno Silva. But that's why I think this fight is so interesting, because if Silva does go out there and throw at the very high pace to make Brad Tavares uncomfortable, we've seen Tavares get tagged early on in fights before. He's one of these guys who, if you let him get comfortable into a fight, kind of settle into the rhythm, then he does become a handful, because again, he doesn't make a lot of big mistakes. But if you do make him uncomfortable early and really start to make him back up, then he won't really throw with a lot of output. He won't get into that rhythm. And we saw Edmund Shabazian do it. Yes, Edmund was able to mix in a kick, whereas Bruno is much more likely to do it with the hands, but still, you can catch Tavares cold early on in fights. And it'll be interesting to see if Silva has that mentality of, hey, come with a big storm early and try to get him out of there quick.
And I mean, Silva was about a 3-1 favorite his last time out, and now the bottom's completely fallen out of Bruno Silva. One bad performance and your chopped liver, but he did look really, really bad. And I know, you know, you carry it forward and you look at Gerald Meerschaert his last time out against Joe Pfeiffer, he got starched, so it really doesn't look good for Bruno Silva. Now, for Silva, I mean, Evolu Sao Tai, he's trained out of the States a little bit in certain fights at certain points, but he definitely has a very high strength of schedule with his training partners. Look at his main guy, Bruno Ferreira, who was able to get a win over, oh my gosh, Gregory Rodriguez in the UFC. But for Silva, it is the big hooks. The only pushback that I have is against Andrew Sanchez, he gets taken down. He throws less than 15 significant strikes in the first round and the second round. 55 in the third round.
But that's my point. He didn't work a lot in those two rounds, yeah, so it's hard to work outside of your own
pace. But you're getting outpaced with the wrestling, and that's taxing on a guy like Silva, where Silva comes out and he had all sorts of zip to the shots. The power was there. He gets kind of a standing TKO knockout win over Sanchez after dropping him, and Sanchez gets back up. It's just for Silva, the highs are high, the low is low. And for a guy like Brad Tavares, he's fought a who's who, a cast of characters inside of the UFC. 14-7 in the UFC. He went 7-1 to start off that career.
And the Drinkus fight was a close one.
And that's the thing that I want to say. Like, you talk about follow-ups. Like, if there was a runner-up to a fight of the night, I said it to start off the show. Brian Barberena, Robbie Lawler, gut fight of the night. But Brad Tavares versus Drinkus du Plessis. And you guys, Twitter and Reddit, they don't like Drinkus du Plessis all of a sudden because he's putting his name out there for that middleweight title shot. But that fight that Brad Tavares had against Du Plessis, they put it on each other. And I know Du Plessis and his coach have talked about, well, he couldn't get the oxygen in through his nose.
That's not really how it works.
But a guy like Brad Tavares, the leg kicks, he didn't give up. He didn't get knocked out. He really did have a good shot. And before that, the two wins, he sent Shoeface to the PFL. He also sent Omari Akhmedov to the PFL. So for Brad Tavares, it's the leg kicks, it's the steady wrestling. He is a prototypical extreme couture guy that has wrestling in his back pocket but likes to strike, has good output, and he's going to test Bruno Silva in some of those areas where we've seen Silva tested in the UFC, but Gerald Meerschaert was able to beat him. By striking. I know he submitted him, but
it's kind of wild.
With his striking. So Bruno Silva's got to get back on the hill. Brad Tavares, again, he's a guy that's kind of been around for a very, very long time. He even dropped Talis Laettes with those leg kicks. Tavares is favored ever so slightly in the matchup. Silva open to plus 110. He's a plus 135. Brad Tavares open minus 130. He's a minus 167. We have a look at the topology votes, Matt. Surprise to us, they are to you. The tickets have left. The train has left the station. I'm going to say over under 70% Brad Tavares.
I think it'll be under.
It's going to be under ever so slightly. 764 total votes, 65% Tavares, 86% by decision. For the 35% that have Silva, 64% by knockout. Do you have Steady Eddie Tavares or Bruno Silva?
Brad Tavares is going to win this fight until he gets hurt. Is that a fair statement to make? He could get hurt in like the 90th second. Or he could get hurt with a second left in the fight and win. You know, like, I think he's going to win a lot of those in-betweens outside of the big actions. Now, could Silva hurt him with a big hook? Could he threaten with some submissions even if Brad Tavares goes for a takedown? Yes, I think he could have some of those actions. But I think it is going to be very difficult for Silva to go through and win a decision against a guy like Brad Tavares. So, not that I'm discounting Silva's opportunities to win this fight, but Tavares is a very steady fighter. And sometimes that does get him caught because he doesn't fight at this crazy pace where he's really going to wow you and look like a Max Holloway against a Calvin Kattar. But I think a fighter like that is going to pose Bruno Silva issues, and that's why I do a Brad Tavares.
And I think Tavares is a really smart pick in this one. Yoel Romero was able to stun and drop Brad Tavares. Tim Boach was able to do it. You were able to see Whitaker do it. I mean, Shabazzian was able to do it early. I think Bruno Silva is going to be able to get back in. So people are going to laugh at me in the comment sections, I'm sure. I'm terrible at picking fights right now in the last month, but I'm going with Bruno Silva. Give me Blindado in the matchup. We're split on the pick. Matt, we have two fights left on this card. Song Yadong is taking on Ricky Simone in the main event. Sergey Pavlovich taking on Curtis Blaydes. You're not going to want to miss it. Just keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
The hottest division in the sport heats up in the co-main event coming up this weekend from that small Apex cage in Vegas. We have Song Yadong taking on Ricky Simone. Matt, both of these guys in the UFC, 8-2 for Song Yadong. He's got a draw in there too, but you look at these two fighters, they're on an absolute heater. Ricky Simone hasn't lost a fight in a meaningful amount of time. Song Yadong lost in his first UFC main event, his last time out against Corey Sandhagen. His eyebrow, it kind of evaded him a little bit. And Sandhagen gets the finish at the end of the fourth round. Yadong definitely had his moments in that fight, really pressed a pace. But when you look at both of these guys, Matt, we've seen them evolve so much inside of the UFC's octagon. Ricky Simone coming in, he was that workhorse wrestler from the Pacific Northwest. He was the LFA champ. He comes in, he fights Merab Dvalishvili. He has that big time fight of the night there. He's got performance bonuses, at least one in his last time against Jack Shore. But that's really where I want to focus on this for Ricky Simone. His boxing has really progressed since he's been inside of the UFC, and he's a longtime ATT Portland guy, Vancouver, Washington, all the way across from Portland, Oregon.
I don't know if this is the fight to showcase
isn't, but you really do have to talk about it because his last time out against Jack Shore, he was bobbing and weaving. He was switching stances on the outside. Shore wasn't able to pump the jab. Ricky Simone, he clips him with that right hand. And then it's like, oh my gosh, like I dropped him. Sack of potatoes, he gets on top, he gets that arm triangle choke win. For Ricky Simone, I hate to make the recency bias comparison, but his last time out, on the outside, moving around, he looked like Lando Venata on the outside with his movement.
Is that a fighter you want to get compared to?
In and out and on the outside, but he was out of range. Venata wasn't out of range when he fought Zellhuber. But when you look at a matchup like this, Matt, for Ricky Simone, where the boxing has gotten better, the right hand that lands against the Sun Tsao when he finishes him, the fight that he has against Brian Kelleher where he takes away the distance, crowds it, and works in his takedowns. Ricky Simone's been one of those guys for a really long time, and now he kind of gets that shine of a co-main event against a guy like Song Yadong who, I mean, this guy coming into the UFC at such a young age, still only 25, comes in at 21. He's had bonuses. He's had big opportunities. He's gotten better. He struggled against some wrestlers, but he really has come out on the other side quite polished. I love this matchup, Bantamweight Matt.
I love the matchup too, but I think we have to be hesitant about some of the gains Ricky Simone's made on the feet. I don't think he's going to be striking a lot in this matchup against a guy like Song Yadong, especially from the outside. I do think we will get a much more hesitant version of Ricky Simone just because the speed is going to be such a big advantage for Song Yadong in this matchup. I don't think Ricky Simone, for as good as his advancements have been with his technique on the feet, you can't make up for the speed disadvantage that you will have in those exchanges.
It's nice to just give guys shine, you know?
No, it is. But again, this isn't the matchup that I think he's going to really be able to showcase in this. So I think he's going to really struggle in the feet or on those exchanges with a guy like Song Yadong because Song not only has the speed, he has the power to go along with it, and he has the boxing combinations going to the body and to the head. Now, Ricky does have the X factor that has given Song trouble in a lot of his UFC fights. And I think the best one to go back and watch is the Cody Stamann fight because what was Cody Stamann able to do every time he get on top of Song? Hold him down. It wasn't like Song was able to really scramble and get back up to his feet. It was the fact that he was able to hold him down to the mat. And with Ricky Simone fighting in the manner that he is, being able to disguise his wrestling with his striking, I think it will help him open up that part of his game. I just worry about Ricky Simone on the feet in this fight because if Song doesn't respect the striking of him, if he's able to hit him with two or three shots for every one that Ricky's able to land, and Simone's not able to crowd the distance or really make the cage small, I think it will be difficult for him to really make those advancements adjustments on the feet. Because it's one thing to look good against Jack Shore and an older Sun Tzu on the feet. It's another thing to look good against Song Yadong, who really does have that high-level X factor of his speed.
Yeah, I mean, Ricky Simone took the O from Jack Shore, and he was undefeated as an amateur, and it was a very illustrious career for Jack Shore, undefeated for a long time as a pro, the former Cage Warriors champ. For Ricky Simone, the only loss is he got knocked out by Uriah Faber in one of the biggest shocks I've ever witnessed in MMA, and he got beat to the punch by Rob Font on the outside, which happens. Font's boxing, Song Yadong has boxing. They box at different ranges, so we'll see how that plays out in this matchup. But I have layers to this fight, like a little bit of an onion. So for Song Yadong, the fight against Cody Stamann was definitely a big one, but for Song, he's been training Team Alpha Male for a really long time. I think Song Yadong's best training partner for a fight like this is probably a guy like Josh Emmett, who's got a big fight that's now, I think it's rumored, if not confirmed, for June main event against Ilia Topuria. But a lot of really good fighters in the lower weight classes. Another guy, Alex Munoz, the wrestling coach there, they're only going to get you ready for guys like Simone. But when you look at it for Song Yadong in the UFC, as good as the wrestling has been, the losses to Kyler Phillips, Corey Sandhagen, and then again that draw to Cody Stamann, Kyler Phillips took him down and had a lot of success with those takedowns. Ricky Simone, who did he have in his corners last time out? Fabiano Scherner, the main guy at American Top Team Portland, who was probably a little sad after Ed Herman got, you know, beat last week against Zach Cummings, but also Colin Oyama, who was in the corner for Marlon Vera against Song Yadong. So there are some intricacies there. Who did Song Yadong beat in the UFC who's a good wrestle boxer?
Well, so who Vince owns Morales. The gym he trains at? The Vince, guy who knocked
Vince,
out Ricky Simone.
Vince Morales' cousin is Ricky Simone, his main training partner. So many layers in these fights, or in this fight in particular, for both men. A lot of similarities, a lot of differences, and a lot of ties as we look at it. But yeah, I mean, for Song Yadong, the boxing combinations, the hook that'll throw, even if he doesn't go to the liver side, if he goes to your right side.
I can do both, yeah.
Like, it really is like a Roy Jones-esque.
And he disguises uppercuts up the middle off of the hooks to the body. That's why I just, again, Simone has made the advancements, but beating a guy like Jack Shore has been hurt on the feet multiple times in his UFC career,
yeah,
and an old Sun Tzu is not getting you ready for a guy like Yadong.
No, it's
all.
Just nice to say things.
It's nice to say nice things, but those guys aren't getting you ready for Song Yadong. Whereas Song Yadong was able to outstrike in some parts Corey Sandhagen. Sandhagen's one of the better strikers in the division.
MMA guys with great tukes usually have hot takes. We don't have to make a hot take on it.
I'm not making a hot take. You can watch the fights and just accept it for what it is. These aren't hot takes. Song Yadong is a much better striker than Ricky Simone, and that's why I look at this fight a little bit as a water and oil type fight. I think Simone will have a lot of success with his control on the cage and with his control on the mat. I just think Song is going to be heavily favored in a lot of those exchanges on the feet, even with the advancements of Ricky.
6.55 takedowns average per 15 minutes for Ricky Simone. He's second all-time in bantamweight history at 37. And listen, tied for fifth, also on this card, Brazilian legend Rani Yaya with 28 of them. But when you look at a fight like this, again, it does feel like oil and water, as you said. We have a look at the odds in the matchup. Ricky Simone open plus 105. He's a minus 135 favorite right now. Song Yadong open minus 125. He's a plus 110. We have a look at the fan vote, Matt. Surprise to us there, to you. I'm going to say over-under underdog. I'm going to say over under 65% Song Yadong.
I think it'll be under.
I think it's going to be under. It's under 811 total votes, 58% Simone, 72% by decision for the 42% that I've sung, 59% by knockout. And for Song Yadong, out of the wins, Marlon Moraes, he knocked him out. Julio Arce knocked him out. And he had that split decision against Casey Kenney, who's kind of one of those wrestle-type boxers out of the MMA lab. So, really interesting fight. A lot of different layers in this co-main event. A couple of premier fighters in the best division
100%.
In MMA. Who's your pick in the fight?
I have Ricky Simone, but I think this is going to be one of those fights where it comes down to the 2 minutes of success Song has on the feet versus the 3 minutes of success Ricky might have on the mat. So, I really do think it's going to come down to how much can both guys get done at the ranges that they specify in. And that's why I've been so heavy saying I think Song's going to be heavily favored on the feet. And I think Ricky's going to have a lot of success with his ground control and with the top pressure because Song's not a guy who can really pressure and get back up to his feet. He's not great at creating that separation to get back up. So I do think Ricky, once he completes the takedown, will be able to have a lot of success off it. But I do think it's going to be really difficult for him to get those initial takedowns. So let's say Song, it'd be wild for him to pull that page out of Sandhagen's book and kind of do the flip side. But let's say he does use the elbows and really damage Simone. I can see Song having a great case to winning this fight by the end of it. But I've seen him get taken down and controlled in the past, and for those reasons, I have to pick Ricky Simone.
We'll see if Song Yadong watch Billy Quarantillo versus Edson Barboza and goes to some crazy strikes. I like Ricky Simone with the takedowns. Again, he goes for such a high amount of them, and his cardio doesn't tend to wane as the fights go on. And that just comes with the territory based on his overall martial arts skill set. So for me, I do like Ricky Simon. On the outside, bobbing and weaving, switching stances. We'll see if that kind of wasted movement is able to be cut by a guy like Sung Yadong with such good boxing. And if that crew at a Team Alpha Male can just continue to shore up the takedown defense out of Sung Yadong, because it is overall at a 71% in the UFC. It is pretty darn good. But both of us in the matchup going with Vancouver, Washington's own Ricky Simon in the matchup. I know there's a lot of Sung Yadong fight fans out there. We want to hear from you down below in the comment section from those Ricky Simon ones as well. Apple Podcasts and Spotify, you can find the version of the show. And if you don't, you can continue on here on YouTube, because we have a big time main event with Sergey Pavlovich taking on Curtis Blaydes. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
You got us with Fight Night Picks, as always. One half of your host, Noah Craig Allen. Twitter and Instagram, Craig Allen FNP. With me to my left, to your right, respective socials, Matt Allen FNP. This weekend's main event, you can see it right there from the poster. Sergey Pavlovich taking on Curtis Blaydes, the biggest clash of styles you're going to find. Because for Pavlovich's last five fights, he has been an absolute destroyer. First round knockouts in all of them. And for Blaydes' last three fights, he's looked amazing. He's added to his boxing repertoire. He beats one Chris Daukaus, and he beats Jairzinho Rozenstruik as well his last time out against Tom Aspinall. Unfortunate with the knee injury, but Blaydes was kind of popping out some of that boxing. But when you consider this matchup, Matt, I know a lot of people are going to talk about it. Pavlovich, I mean, he just continues to win, but he might struggle with the wrestling. We saw him with a takedown given up against Alistair Overeem, albeit not a Curtis Blaydes type of takedown. A Curtis Blaydes has trained with Overeem in the past, and boy, did he ever beat him badly with those elbows from the ground and pound. So when you look at a matchup like this one, I found it interesting. Pavlovich training out of ATT with a lot of high-level heavyweights that those guys have. But the stable, it's changed. He's been at the UFC PI training with Alexander Volkov, an old foe of Curtis Blaydes, and Alexei Olenek. Just a couple of tough old fellows.
This fight's like if a lion fought a great white shark. It's like, okay, I need more information, you know? Is it in the jungle? I think the shark would flop around and die pretty quick. Is it in the ocean? I don't know if lions can swim, but I'm assuming the shark would do quite well in that situation. I just think this fight is very much a contrast of styles, and I brought this up between the last three fights that we've had at the top of this main card, because Tavares Silva, one guy steady, one guy burns hot. Yadong Simone, you have a great striker with a lot of variety versus a very good control guy on the ground. And in this fight, Sergey Pavlovich has ungodly power in his hands. When he hits guys, they either get wobbled, well, they pretty much always get wobbled, and then he finishes them shortly after. But Curtis Blaydes is, and it's kind of wild that every single prediction it feels like between these guys comes down to this. Can Curtis Blaydes take down his opponent more times than they hit him in the face on the feet? Because if he can accomplish that, then he's probably going to win this fight. And for Sergey, here's the only thing that I don't love about him compared to some of the other guys who have been able to knock out Curtis Blaydes in the past. When I say some of the other guys, you mean Derek Lewis and Francis. Those guys do throw uppercuts from what I would say better ranges. Sergey's a little bit more uptight with his boxing, and he throws them from a little bit higher. So I'm not as certain if that uppercut's going to land. I think it'll be a good technique, don't get me wrong. I'm just not sure if it's going to be that one-hitter quitter that it was for those guys, that's all.
Sergey Pavlovich will set you out with that jab. He comes over with the right, and once you're hurt, he starts to pummel you with those uppercuts. And that is a huge part of his game. And if you look at it, again, five straight first-round finishes, Golm, then he beats a guy in Maurice Green, and then he beats Shamil Durkhimov. None of those guys in the UFC. He beats Derek Lewis in a main event, and then his last time out, he beats Tai Tuivasa.
Tai came back too fast after the Gone fight. I think that's fair to say.
And he might have, but Pavlovich looked really, really good. Dropped him a couple of times in that one. The uppercuts really were the difference maker. But for Curtis Blaydes, I mean, again, debuts in 2016 and loses to Francis Ngannou. And then he goes on a win streak. And then he loses to Francis. Like, when he's taking on Francis Ngannou, he struggles. When he took on Derek Lewis, it was that big uppercut. But you look at it for Curtis Blaydes, 12-3 with a no contest in the UFC. And that's why I went with the UFC records out here, because it's young in the game for a guy like Pavlovich, who debuted in 2018 against Alistair Overeem in Beijing, of all places. And in that fight, okay, we're at striking distance, and then Overeem closes that gap. And he's able to hold a high almost like a tie defense, high tie defense. He gets into a plum clinch, goes trip with the back leg, and then you have Pavlovich on the ground. And then over him, it was almost like it took him a split second. Well, do I take advantage of this position? He did. He lands really good ground and pound, some elbows, and then Pavlovich is up against the cage, and he can't get back up to his feet. It wasn't the type of, you know, long range, double leg, single leg type of takedown like you're going to get out of a traditional wrestler in a guy in Curtis Blaydes that trains at elevation with. Again, we touched on it. Some good heavyweights, including guys like Alistair Overeem. Now, can Overeem fight in kickboxing tomorrow? No, extenuating circumstances. But for Curtis Blaydes, it definitely is a good look to get a big guy like that that can strike from 100% range against a guy like Pavlovich. And for Blaydes, number one all time at heavyweight with 1 hour, 20 minutes, and 6 seconds of control time, tied for 8th with strikes absorbed per minute, 1.7, and number one all time with takedowns, 62 in the heavyweight division. Number two is Cain Velasquez with 32. There's a big difference between 32.
Cain's a better wrestler than
62
though,
and 34. No.
I think he is. Like, Cain went to the UFC title and was an all-time great mainly due to his wrestling. I think he's a better MMA. I just think numbers, like, you can accumulate a lot of numbers if wrestling is at the forefront of your game. It's just Cain was good enough at the other parts to where he didn't have to just go out there and out-wrestle guys. I still think Cain's the best heavyweight wrestler of all time. For Curtis, though, I wonder if we are going to see him prod the jab a lot in this fight, because Pavlovich will make him pay if he does make a lot of those mistakes from the long range, and Blaydes doesn't have a bad chin. I don't want people to look at some of his past stoppages and think, oh, if you hit him clean, he's going to go down. Look at the Mark Hunt fight. Look at the Rosenstrike fight. He gets hit by some clean shots. He's able to withstand them and then able to have success on the other side. The Rosenstrike fight is an interesting one, though, because Jairzinho was able to defend a lot of the initial takedowns, really most of the takedowns, and make it primarily a striking fight. Now, to Blaydes' credit, he was able to kind of out-jab and out-output Jairzinho in that matchup, but still, that did set a game plan to where, okay, if you're a high-level striker in the heavyweight division, he's not a success 100% of the time with his striking. You can defend some of those takedowns. So I do think for Pavlovich, if he went back and watched that Rosenstrike fight, I do think it would inspire confidence for him. I just wonder if Pavlovich could get back up to his feet if he gets taken down by Blaydes. Because if he doesn't have an answer in getting back up to his feet, maybe he can defend the takedown for 3 or 4 minutes and then kind of waste the last minute or two. But at a certain point, Blaydes is going to get a takedown with like 4 minutes left in the round. And that's going to be the most important part in this fight.
I mean, for Sergey Pavlovich, before he came into the UFC, the last decision win he had to his name was in 2017 against one Mikhail Mokhnatsyan, and at that time he was the Fight Nights Global Heavyweight Champ. He then beat baby Fedor Kirill Sedelnikov, a guy who was on the same card as Bobby Green on an Affliction card headlined by Fedor. But Matt, when you look at this matchup, I mean, Curtis Blaydes is slightly favored, but we always do this in the main event. We throw it on over to you guys over in the YouTube community tab, and right now, all kinds of votes, 705 of them thrown out there earlier today, 57% going with Pavlovich. Out of the comments sections, Moko saying, Ngannou didn't run from John Jones, he ran from Sergey Pavlovich. Air Dog saying, if Pavlovich can keep this on the feet, Blaydes is in trouble. Bill Cipher, Pavlovich KOs him on a failed takedown attempt. Blaydes struggles against guys with big power. Derek Lewis and Francis were both able to catch Blaydes when he was going for takedowns. And I'll go with one more, Tyler Ferreira. Fajeda, you're out there every week, Tyler. I apologize if I mispronounce your last name. Close fight, but I'll pick Blaydes. So again, the fans going with Sergey Pavlovich, the odds with Curtis Blaydes. I mean, there are a lot of, you know, conversations going on out there, and I really want to hear from the folks in the comment section on this one. But it is. It's the biggest clash of styles fight that you're going to have. A first-round knockout artist, a guy that likes to take people down, and for Pavlovich, great to train with a guy like Volkov. For Blaydes, great to train with a guy like Overeem. So there is that familiarity there. But for me, I like Curtis Blaydes. I mean, to have that skill set, to be able to dictate where the fight's going to take place, it's just in that close in-between where we saw Lewis and Ngannou knock him out. Can Pavlovich do that? He can. I mean, uppercuts are a primary source of his power. And that's what Lewis and Ngannou were able to land. That left hand that places you, the right hand that follows it up, and if he backs Blaydes up against the cage for a panic takedown, that plays into the hand of a guy like Pavlovich. This guy has some of the best power that we've seen, period. And as the kind of joke was out there by Moko in the community tab, like, yeah, Ngannou ran from a guy like Pavlovich. My goodness gracious, does Pavlovich have that power? I do like Blaydes, though, with those takedowns, and that Overeem one takedown wasn't the same, but I do shade Blaydes in a matchup.
Not that MMA math matters, but like, if we're going to talk about the Overeem fight against Pavlovich a lot, what did Curtis do to Alistair when they fought?
gave him a permanent scar on his forehead.
That's one of the most, like, that's some of the most hellacious ground and pound we've ever seen in the UFC. It was just full guard, elbow, elbow, elbow. We've always kind of wanted to see that aggressive version of Curtis Blaydes since that performance. I do have him in the matchup, but he offers a lot of opportunities to be hit by the big shot. Now, he doesn't get hit by a lot of big shots, but the big shot is available. And of course, like you've mentioned, Pavlich has that type of power. So I do have Blaydes in the matchup, but it should be a fun one.
Matt, it is a big time fight on the main card in the main event. I mean, Pavlich taking on Blaydes. You made it this far. The subscribers, the flow that came in last week, we certainly appreciate it. If you've been hesitating, make sure to toss that sub and the likes. They're definitely appreciated so we can beef up the video. Some great content coming out this week with Fight Night Picks. Question Mark Kicks is 2 hours before the prelims, gives us a final opportunity to look in at the weigh-ins. We did have a fighter miss weight last weekend, so we'll see how that affects the fighters coming up this week. Also to note, small cage at the UFC's Apex. We'll see whose hand that plays into in this matchup and the others as well. Really appreciate the support from those Fight Night Picks faithful. You're going to want to keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, and as we always say,
let's get into it.